Now, before we begin the next Perek, Perek Yud Aleph for today, let's just think about some of the strange patterns that seem to be coming out here that give us an indication of how different what has come from all we've had before. We don't hear anything about the massive problem, which was at the beginning of the Sefer, of the Malchut HaRevi'i. This is the main issue, everybody. I mean, we didn't even bother discussing the interim Malchut initially. He is absolutely astounded. What is this? What is it supposed to mean? How could Malchut reach a stage like this? What does it mean for a Malchut to be constructed of dirt? I don't even understand what that's all about. And this comes as a massive surprise to him, in which there's a whole different definition of Malchut. It's no longer Shilton. It comes about on its own, and so on and so forth. That was the major finish at the beginning of the book. Here, we're sort of going backwards to deal with the things that didn't make such an impact at the moment. Malchus Bavel, where he was already there, and he saw what happens with the Lion of Bavel. He's now standing now at the intersection of Bavel and Paras in the previous parak. So, okay, he's already seen Daryavesh, he's working at building the Beit HaMikdash, Bismano, and now there's the years of Paras that are coming ahead. He sees there's a problem to be the Beit HaMikdash. 21 years, he's going to make a Tainis. That Tainis helps Daniel, Gavriel, to arrange a period now of relative peace in which it's possible to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. And we have this whole vision that's going to be a possibility of an ultimate tikkun and so on and so forth. Somehow or other, the big ideas that certainly we relate to as being the major issues of the beginning, and certainly the Christians view that whole thing as the real meaning of the eschatological times and so on. This sort of gets pushed aside over here, and Gavriel's main concern now is, oh my God, what am I going to do now? The Greeks are coming. And we don't look at the Greeks as being such Malkayoman are coming in. I don't have anything to do about that. All of a sudden, we're given a discussion about Tav, Emet, versus Eino Emet, Teshuvah, nobody can help me. All in the same, almost as if there's an interruption. I'm going to tell you, I got to go. This is terrible. There's nobody there to help me. I was able to handle this. I can't handle this. Only Michael is handling this. You got to know about the Shuvah before I leave. See you later. And then we get back to it in what supposedly is the next parak. So this is like a sort of a non sequitur in the middle. And the Gemara is such a beautiful description of this non sequitur. Oi, yeah, wow. Valenta asks me, okay, now we'll get back to the discussion. It's very strange. Well, Maisa will see that the entire next parak, there's a complete change of ambiance. Because up until now, we had these vague historical issues of the major things that were patterns in what was happening between Persia and between Alexander and the breakup of Alexander's kingdom. We had the four wings of the tiger before, now we have they're called crouching tigers, but you know. Now here we have the previous parak we were talking about, the horn that breaks up into four pieces. Very, very general kind of things that we can understand the references, and even I understood really in the details. Who cares? All of a sudden, the next part is, I mean, you have to be a bookish of a bookie of history in order to understand what's going to be going on in the next part. Every last detail, marriage between four corners of what used to be Alexander's kingdom, and all of what the historians refer to as the War of the Women, where you have the whole problem of the intermarriage that they tried to do between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and it's very strange that all of a sudden we're interested in this stuff. And of course, this is the period in which it lands up with the issues of Hanukkah and mentions the Antiochus. That's where we get the problems of the Samigdash and the Ptolemies. That is Nogea, the translation of the Torah into Greek, and I don't know, like various things that don't really seem to be all that important. Now, the truth is, though, if you think about it, the cosmic nature of the battle, that cosmic nature is a Yaakov Esav issue. It was the only, that cosmic battle was the only part that's discussed in great detail in the Torah itself, beginning with Yitzchak Avinu's confusion, the interaction of Yaakov and Esav throughout, the detailed interactions, the Chochmah, the Gidanosha, the various elements that are merames to the ultimate issues that are meant to be dealt with in Chanukah as a prelude to the issues that will come up with the Romans. It's very striking that the only period that is left, in a sense, untouched here by the Keach of the Malachim in the Sorim and the Bezen Shamala and the attempt to deal with it through Daniel, and untouched by Jacopo Vito's immediate approach, and in fact, the one thing that is left as a festering sore within Claudia Searle itself, which was never the problem. The problem was always the relationship of Yisrael and the grave. All of a sudden, we reach a total departure from the before and the after, in which the main issue is the fact that Yisrael is incapable of dealing with Yom. Internally, not externally. Now, this is a remarkable thing. In other words, we know, we talk about the four Malchus and the Golos. There's a Golos of Bovhal and Madai. There's a Golos of Yavam, which doesn't affect Eretz Yisrael, in the sense that nobody is thrown out of Eretz Yisrael. The Golos of Yavam has nothing to do with a Girush. It's internal. Now, the fact that it's internal, of course, means that the roots of it were found internally, immediately after Yaakov Avinu deals with his Tsar. Immediately after Daniel deals with his Gavriel, deals with his Tsar, which is the Tsar Malchei Paras, and that is, we are able to deal with. We are able to deal with Rome, albeit over a period of thousands of years. But the one thing that stayed from the time of the breakdown of Yosef and his brothers through the time of the breakdown of Malchut Yehuda with Malchut Yisrael, Malchut Yerobam from Yosef, Malchut Yehuda that represents the other brothers, this goes on for century after century after century, was the source, if you think about it, of the original Galut HaBavel in the first place, because that's what tore everybody apart and allowed the breakdown of the Aseret HaShvatim, as we saw before Malachi, to affect Malchut Yehuda as well. That is the one thing that Gavriel says, I can't deal with it. Yaakov Avinu, we know for a fact, couldn't deal with it. If there's one thing that shattered him, that was what shattered him. He was able to deal with everything else in life except for the internal dissension. So that means that the next parak is indeed a completely different ambient, in which precisely the same way, if you take a look in the Chumash, the part of the Chumash that is most picayune, that is most detailed of interrelationships of women and family and kids and jealousies, is the story of Yosef and his brothers, where all of these issues begin. Remarkably, the Hellenistic impact on Israel is defined by the Navi in terms of local politics that have everything to do with exactly the same type of idiotic, it appears to us, idiotic interactions that involve the wife of Ptolemy II, the daughter of Ptolemy II, the wife of Antiochus, the murders of Berenice, and I mean, it's just crazy kind of things. And yet, it's reflective of precisely the issues of Yavan that take place within B'nai Yisrael itself. Therefore, when Gavriel leaves him with this message, and this message relates to the nature of Gzar Din and Teshuvah and so on, and says, about this, there's nothing I can do. And about this, I cannot invoke you, because you are helpless when it comes to this. What it's telling us is, not just now you're on your own. I mean, you know, that could be something external that you're on your own. But rather, if the only one who can possibly deal with this is Michael Sarkem, then what that means is that this is a problem in that manifestation of the Yichud of Yisrael. And the only one that has any power in this next issue with Yavan is that, because of the fact that it's internal. Therefore, this, as opposed to the things we understood before, we're over there. I'm here. I want you to understand. The more you understand, the better off you'll be. Because the more you understand, the more you'll be able to utilize this kayach of tefillah and awareness and be able to motivate the Sari Shalmala and fight as needed. But this is no longer a question of understanding yourself. Why is that? Because for the first time ever, and the last time in a sense, because even what happens afterwards in Rome is just an extension on an intellectual level of what happens to us in terms of Yavan. For the first time, the Galut is entirely intellectual. And because it's entirely conceptual, and the whole idea of the Hellenistic dangers to Israel go all the way back to way, way prehistory, in which the difference between Yefet and the understanding of the beauty of Yefet, which is clearly connected, the whole tikkun of Tiferes of Yaakov Avinu is an alternative to Yosef himself, who is so beautiful, provides now a challenge, which is the challenge of, literally, of the same simon of Chochmah that we have, which is the simon of the olive leaf, and the olive to Yavan means exactly what it does to us in Chanukah. It's a question of Chochmah, a question of the menorah for the first. And the Haaretz Shelach Yadreim, it's a completely different type of Golus. It leaves an impact on us that is a permanent impact that completely changes the conceptual basis of our Tfisa. So although up until this time there were profound changes in our perception of the nature of history, the nature of the development of Malchus, the power of Geula, there were no tools for reconceptualizing. Therefore, the issues, in some level, were very simple, because they were dealing with externals rather than internals. But when you're talking about Yavan, as Gavriel points out now, there's nobody that's going to be of any help here at all. Only your own growth in ways that will change you internally. It's no longer enough for me to give you Hadracha so that now you'll understand, I'll lift you up, and now I'll tell you, listen, you really got to work on this and understand what it is that I'm showing you, because obviously through that understanding, you'll be able to address it. I can't give you that understanding because you don't have it yet. I am, after all, only a manifestation of what's in you. And therefore, this is something that needs to be achieved painfully, locally, by changing your conceptual space. So that means that we're being told that Yavan is a story of a completely different order. And therefore, the details that follow are details that absorb the energies of Yisrael on one level, purely politically, and yet hidden behind the politics of all of this is the ongoing cultural warfare, which is really what it was all about and what came to a head at the time of Hanukkah. Was absolutely the nature of Kulturkampf rather than any type of military issue at all. And because of that, we're looking now to begin a parak that is a parak that has nothing in common with the ambience of the Prakim until now. Of that achievement. Correct. Is higher than Gavriel. He doesn't say it. He says, you need to know that this is Nogei HaTeshuvah. It's not just a simple question of what's happening in the Beis Din Shomala. And, I mean, because of that, it's very much a question not only of your intellectual kohot, but the way in which those kohot are going to have to fend for themselves. So that Hanukkah becomes now acts of immense courage, which don't appear in these other goliot in the same way. It's not the same level of warfare. It's a whole different idea. So, Perek Yudal, Va'ani. This is a continuation. There should be no parak right here. This is a continuation of the words of Gavriel. And now that I've told you the mess that we're in, I want you to understand that initially, when it was the time of Dariush, I was very happy to be on his side, is the way many of the first word. I supported him. Because there was nothing contradictory about me supporting someone who could be used to build the Beis HaMikdash and who represented no internal threat. And so at the beginning of this whole process, which is when the whole story begins, way back at the beginning of this discussion, in those days, it wasn't a problem. But now, I got to tell you, the attack. So now we're getting back to the Ktav Emet idea that we just said. So this was what appeared to be a non sequitur, in which all of a sudden, oh man, it got really tough. And Mikhail got back. Let me get back to the story. What is that all about? Because I'm contrasting what it was that I was once able to do and how it is that I related even as someone who was active on behalf of Yisrael in that Beis Din. I had no problem backing Dariush because he wasn't a danger. But now, Beata, Emet Agid Lach. I mentioned that there's certain things I have to own up to. Emet in terms of there's nothing that I can do about it. There's not much more time to go. You're going to have to get through the reins of Koresh, Achashverosh, Daryovesh. There's some questions as to whether Koresh is really included in this, or whether there's another Melech, whether Artaxasta is somebody else. And there's other kings that show up, of course, in the Persian reckoning that the Ibn Ezra includes in these years. But it's relatively unimportant. As the Gemara says, Artaxasta, Achashverosh, Daryovesh, these are names that are generic names. We often find the same guy being referred to in different ways. We're not concerned particularly, because remember, Shlosha Malachim might be more than three humans. Shlosha Malachim may be these identifications. So, the Dariovish types, the Atashastas type, the Achashverosh types, or whatever. This isn't even important, as I pointed out to you earlier. When it comes to the Malachim up to Yavan, we're not interested in precise identification. We're only interested in patterns. The only time we become interested in precise identification is in Yavan itself, because of the nature of Golas Yavan. And so, the problem is that the Rivi'i will be Yashir Osher Gadol. He is going to get into trouble because the fourth one maybe Dariovish the second, it may be the son, as Yosefun points out, that there was another son, which in Hebrew is Bamavisha. But whatever it is, there is a fourth one. We know that the one that ends up really being fought by Alexander is called Daryavish. So on some level, this is the last one. And he becomes Yashir Osher Gadol Mikol. He becomes much richer than any of the other. Ukeches Katoba Oshro. And as he becomes so empowered by his own riches, some learn Becheskato, having gained those riches through Chazakah illicitly, he got half the world against him, who were ready to join any type of alliance just to undo him. And there's other explanations as well. He could use the Osher to buy mercenaries, use the Greek city-states against others, whatever it means. Again, Ya'ir Hakol et Malchut Yavan. He got everybody involved, and in the end, got Malchut Yavan. So either it means against Malchut Yavan in Milchama, or it means in the end getting Malchut Yavan to come up against him, which of course was the reality of what happened, but he woke up the sleeping giant. Essentially, that's what it means. And in doing so, the Amad Melech Gibor, then came a great king of Yavan, and this is Alexander, Umashal Nimshal Rav, who became exceedingly powerful, started spreading across the earth. The Asakir, so he was able to do whatever the heck he wanted, and that we saw earlier in the vision that Daniel had, in which he was able to fight against Daryavish, killed him, nobody could stand up against him, and in the end, the Parsim now became enslaved for tribute to the Greeks. The Asakir, so. And as we saw earlier in the dream, Uche Amdo, just at the height of his strength, Tishaver Malchuto, suddenly and inexplicably, the Malchut of Alexander was broken up. And as we saw in the two previous visions of the flying the four wings, or the horn that was metallic at the four parts, so what happened is that indeed, Vatechatz li'arba ruchot ha-shamayim, and those kingdoms now split into four separate places, and now what was once the great power of Alexander became now in the west. Again, these are all relative to Eretz Yisrael that we're talking about in the four directions. We're talking about Macedonia, relatively west, the northwest, but much more significantly, in terms of distance, much more significantly west, of course. So here we refer to it as west. And then we refer to the Persian element towards the east, because again, these are the Eretz Yisrael. We talk about Bavel, we talk about Bavel, Syria, always as the north. Even though obviously you could see that as not, it's certainly not too north. It's very, only in comparison to Persia, we're going to call it north. Okay, fine. In terms of Iran, we call it north. And so we have the Egyptian south. Again, he's the Eretz Yisrael, we call that south, because Benikertas is south. And so those became now the four Ruchot HaShamayim that we spoke about earlier. These became now those kingdoms. And the Lola Afrito, it did not go to the children of that Melech Gibor. So it was not his heirs that benefited from this, because in the end, but basically, both of his kids, both his bastard son, Heracles, and his own son, Alexander, were both killed as children. They were murdered in all of this tumult. So he didn't get anything. It was all out. So he sort of appeared from nowhere and disappeared into nowhere. And the Lochamashlo, nor should you think that any of these kingdoms ever approached any sense of Malchus that was the equivalent of Alexander. The Lochamashlo, Asher Mashal, Kitinatesh Malchuto, Ulacharini Vadeila. And you should know, his Malchus was left hefker, was taken over by so many different people. Generals, brothers, children of generals, God only knows the internecine fighting that was going, which of course is a rebus, exactly what was going on in terms of Israel as well. So what happens here is, initially, we have to understand, as part of every single vision of Yavan, there needs to be first an empire. An empire that is bi'uchad, underneath one individual who has a true vision of what Yavan could be. But that vision, remarkably, is as endangered as the vision of Yisrael, of what Yisrael can be. And that golus of Yavan is precisely, needs to be dealt with in the same way that the internal breakdown in which various elements of Yavan are separated out, and of course this is the history of Yavan, is the separating out out of the different approaches of the other to the extent that it, I mean, almost literal opposites in terms of the primary city-states of Yavin. Arayon, those impactful issues of how they were related to by Klal Yisrael are viewed as the splintering of the kingdom. Tinatesh Malchuto, in exactly the same way that the splintering of Yaakov Avinu between Yosef Ve'echa, or the splintering of the Malchus of Yisrael between Yerovam and all of the other Malchus Yisrael and Malchus Yehuda was a splintering of vision, and yet needed to come first from a unified vision in order for it to be able to be dealt with. Here too, Yavin is not a bunch of city-states. Yavin is an international, the first time on this level of a well-conceptualized, understood vision, which was the first time that something could be made, Mul Yisrael, as almost a mirror image of the nature of Yisrael, to such an extent that indeed, as we'll see, the translation of the Torah into Greek, the fact that the Rambam says the only language in human history that ever had the richness to be able to have a Torah that would literally be kosher as a Sefer Torah was that ancient Greek. That became the vision now of anybody who's studying the classics and wants to understand what humanity thinks and what are those paradigms, what are the base, has to do with an ancient Greek. It's an unbelievable thing. And these things, they're put all the way back in the Yavta L'Kibli Yefet, the original brachas and the breakdown between Shem and Yefet, together with Noach, at the time that humanity is searching for its primal roots. Nothing like this has ever happened before. And it's because of that that now we see that history reflects Yavan and Yisrael in a way that makes it, surprisingly, all the more difficult. Because where something is only an external challenge, then the very power of the civilization makes it easier to handle. But when it comes at you from so many different directions, and there's something in it for everybody, then it becomes tremendously powerful. Because it's a meta-human experience. So that the Grecian idea is very different depending where it's coming from. Historically, it's very, very different. The question of how much people were absorbed into Yavin varies culture by culture. And the interaction and the spawning of the offshoots of things that began with Greek thought and became, as we see, I mean, in Edom, how powerful the Choshech al Pnei Tahom, the way the Torah puts it, in my Spreshes, that Choshech is only really Yavin. It covers the Tahom, which is Esav. So Esav himself is still a barbarian, always was a barbarian, always will be a barbarian. It's the Tahom that we see still evinced so clearly in European culture. It just scratched the surface, the Alpinei, scratched the surface, and you see the barbarians underneath. The only thing that provides a thin veneer of civilization is the extent at which Yavan still is Shalit as the modality of thought and expression and beauty and so on. But the moment that the Nazis get in there, everything goes back to this absurd Menshova and the idiotic architecture that people laugh at for years afterwards. Because it's all about the Esav of the Al-Kharba, the Tichya, and so on. And everything needs to express that. The Nazi art, the Nazi architecture, the Nazi music, and the overdone power of it all. The Wagnerian opera. So it all becomes now a question of to what extent do we indeed relate to this Yavin? And so as we get into now for the first time, I need to tell you these things. And so now we're going to concentrate on the development of two out of the four kingdoms. And that's simply because those are the ones that were Nogea Eretz Yisrael. So after Alexander broke up, the thing that we're going to focus on, yesterday we discussed briefly the fact that it broke into four pieces. And what interests us now is Ptolemy, the first, I'm going to start with, was called Ptolemy Soter in the south, and he now ruled over the area that was essentially Mitzrayim, and expanded outwards in the end to include Eretz Yisrael, which was very important, and which is important to everybody. And then we had Seleucus the First, who was the son of Antiochus. He was called Nicator, son of Antiochus, and this becomes now known as the Melech HaNegev and the Melech HaTzafon, respectively. So the Melech HaNegev is the southern king, and the Melech HaTzafon, that would be Antioch and all of the ones that became known as Antiochus, based on that king. And so we begin the story with Vayachazak Melech HaNegev u'mitzarav, so that the king of the south, that is to say the Egyptian section, Ptolemy's first Soter, the son of Lagos, he ended up growing very, very strong, and even u'mitzarav. So the king of the south, simple meaning seems to be, will grow stronger, meaning than his alternative, which was the king of the north, Seleucus Nicator, and even of all of his noblemen. There is, of course, another approach, and that is the approach of the Malbim, among others, who learns Um Min Sarav goes on the next part. Um Min Sarav Abaya Chazakalav. So that means that one of the ones who were his Sarim will become stronger than him, because Seleucus had originally been one of the generals of the Ptolemy, and he now became the one that represented the greatest danger to Ptolemy's own empire. And this was after he had been made now the one who was in charge of the area of Bavel. And this actually refers back to a little bit of the earlier history. Seleucus originally was conquered, really, or was in danger of being captured by Antigonus, who was from the Persian. And because of that, he ran away, he joined up with Ptolemy, and he was able to defeat Antigonus together with Ptolemy. But afterwards, this Seleucus now became once again, so this is the second time, he became once again the king of the area of Bavel, and it was then that he became stronger even than the one that had originally helped him, so much for honor among thieves, and became now the one who was Vaya Chazakalav. Umashal Mimshal Rav Mimshal To. So then his own Mimshala, his area, his domain, is a very great domain. The way the Malbim learns it is, he will be Moshel, and even more than the king of the south, meaning than Ptolemyus. Because what happened was that after Antigonus and Seleucus came back to Bavel, he actually embarked on a tremendous expansion. And he expanded to India, he expanded to the west to Syria, and that's when the word Antioch becomes unimportant. That became now, he built Antioch, he made that capital, and he came now, ended up being the king of all of the areas that Alexander the Great had conquered in Asia itself. So he actually expanded tremendously. But at the end of some time, they decided it was a time to bring peace between them. And this was after Antiochus the First, who was the son of Seleucus, and he died. And his son, Antiochus the Second, who was called Theos, he wanted to make peace together with now the Ptolemyus. And at this time already, it was the second Ptolemyus, the famous Ptolemyus Philadelphus. And that was the Ptolemy that had insisted on the Targum HaShivim. And the fighting that was between them actually had to do, as we'll see later on, how central Eretz Yisrael was, had to do with the nature of who was going to be the Melech over Eretz Yisrael. So originally, Eretz Yisrael was considered to be part of Mitzrayim, and therefore it was given over to the Ptolemyus. But Seleucus, he wanted to make Eretz Yisrael part of the Tzafon. After the first Seleucus died, there now became a tremendous amount of fighting that broke out between them, and the second Ptolemyus, Ptolemy Philadelphus, and Antiochus Theos, wanted to make peace and to stop all of the fighting over Eretz Yisrael, and they agreed that what they would do was, they would be mitchaber through the fact that Ubat Melech HaNegev, Tavor El Melech HaTzafon, Lasot Meisharim. So that Antiochus had agreed now to Ptolemy that he would get rid of his original wife, who was Laodotus, and or Laodotius in Hebrew. So she was a daughter of his own uncle. Now that uncle, actually it's interesting, he's called Achias, and he was an Ach to the first Antiochus, and he had two children already. And Ptolemy had persuaded him that if he would get rid of Laodotus, and he would agree to marry the daughter of Ptolemy, this is Ptolemy the Second, remember, whose name was Berenice, that way they would make a yichud of the two Malchiyot, and that the child that would be born to him from Berenice would end up now becoming a melech of both the north and the south. And this way, they would be able to be Kailal Eretz Yisrael between the two of them. However, what actually happened was very different. V'lo ta'atzor koach hazeroa, v'lo ya'amod uzro'o, v'tinatem hi, umidi'eha, v'hayolada, umachazika be'itim, and that would be the end of all of them. So she was unable to stop the koach hazeroa, because what happened was that Antiochus, after Ptolemy died, he left Berenice, who was Ptolemy's daughter, and he left the son that he had agreed to make the melech, and he went back to his original wife, to Laodotus. However, she didn't trust him, and she was afraid that at the end, he would say that the son of Berenice should be the Melech, which of course would have put Berenice and her whole family into a terrible situation, and they would be viewed as a danger to the developing Malchut and would be murdered. So she decided she ought to act first, and she actually poisoned Antiochus, and she had Berenice and the son from Berenice and everyone that was together with Berenice had the whole lock stock of them murdered. And so this was the end of the great plan. According to the Malbim, what this means is Volotat, so she will, meaning Berenice, could not stop Antiochus from going back to his original wife. And Loya Mozro, which would mean that he also and his chaos, his own strength, Antiochus, will not stand for very long, because the truth is that he died suddenly, not many years after he married this Berenice. And his arm, referring to his son, also did not end up surviving. And instead what happened is that she, Vatinaten, she was given over into the hands of her enemies, including now those, Miviel, those who had brought her. And so Enofinami had Antiochus live, and he would have named now this new son his own successor, the one who would be the Melech. That would have meant a complete change in the Seder Amalchus, because there would have been now very strong Malchus that included both the Tzafon and the Darom, which conceivably could have reunited the Greeks and made them once again into the type of Malchus Olam that Alexander had done. But because of the fact that Antiochus was murdered in this way, turned out that his Zeroa, Koyach, who was the future, ended up never really being able to act. Lo Yamod, again, possibly this means Lo Yamod is the sense of it was never able to stand up. In other words, they never were able to do what it was that they had planned to do, which would have changed the entire course of history. But instead, she was given over now into the hands of the ones who were his original wife, who ended up killing her, who ended up killing Nivi'eha, who ended up killing Ayolada. Yolada would be her nanny, and that's interesting because I mean, to say Yolada means mom is your father doesn't make sense. We have no record of Ptolemy being killed by this. And so it could be Yolada is very similar to actually the story that this is most reminds us of during that period of Yaakov Uvanov, as we mentioned. So there too, the Yolada, meaning the nanny, was extremely important. This was the crying over Devorah. And so that she too was destroyed, and her machazik abitin, the one who was machazik her in a most difficult time, her political advisors, or machazik abitin in terms of the newspapers, the ones who gave her political spin, or it could just mean her support, machazik abitin, the ones who during that period were her backbone. And what happened was that Amad b'netzer shorasheha kano, and so one who would grow up, a sayan, would come from her family on a very strong foundation, v'yavo el achayo, and he comes now to the army, v'yavo b'ma'oz melech hatzafon, coming into the very deep and most fortified area of the king of the north, and then v'asabem do as he wished with them, v'echazik, and grab them and hold them. So this now, again, if we take the Malbim's approach and the strongly historical approach, this is referring to Berenice's brother. So this was already Ptolemy the Third, and his name was Eurygetes. He became now the Melech after Philadelphus, after the translation of the Shivim, and he became now the new Melech HaDorom. And both Ptolemy and Antiochus, the second of each, were basically gone, and in a very short time, they both died. We don't know exactly what happened. And he came now to the army, because Berenice herself had really recognized that she was in tremendous trouble after seeing that Antiochus was poisoned. And she went to a fortress, that was the famous fortress of Seleucia, and she gathered together an army. Her brother, Ptolemy the Third, came to save her, but she was killed, as we saw in the pasuk before, and it was too late for him to be able to save her. And so, that would be one way of understanding the Vayavo B'ma'oz. The only problem is, of course, that the Vayavo B'ma'oz in that sense would mean doubling the meaning of the first part. So, therefore, it's probable that Vayavo B'ma'oz means exactly what it implies, that the strong cities of the north, of the Seleucia, were captured now by Ptolemy the Third. And indeed, he did capture now Antioch, together with Seleucia. And he did with Eliasabam whatever he wanted, and he included now the capturing of Eretz Israel. We don't know precisely how far it is that he got and how much territory he took over, but it is known that he had expanded the area of what was the original Ptolemy kingdom in the north, of the south. He expanded it tremendously, and according to Malba mentions that he also had Laodosia, he had her murdered as well, and there's many other things that the Mepharshim bring over here, that he killed also Laodosia's son, and so on. Again, it's not clear from general history where this comes from. V'gan Elohim and their gods, im nesichehem, together with their noblemen, im kleichem datam, with the most expensive and beautiful kalim that they had made out of kesev, zahav, all of these things he captured by Shavi, he took them as war spoils, brought them to Mitzrayim, Yavim Mitzrayim, v'hu shanim ya'amod, mi'melech hatzafon. And because of this action, he will be able to stand strong without any worry of any attack by the Melech HaTzafon. You'll notice that this is the first time that it openly mentions Mitzrayim as being the meaning of the Melech HaDorom, so that it makes very good sense. I'm not talking about some kind of the king of Antarctica. We're talking about Ptolemy from Mitzrayim. Now, according to Rambam, according to Malbim, when it says Ruh Shanim Yamod, it means Shanim as a minimum, meaning that it was only 2 years. Again, we don't know from general history. We don't know if that's true. But we do know that there was a reason that Ptolemy, this is now Ptolemy the Third, why he had to leave in the middle of these conquests, and it appears that there was some kind of rebellion that he had to put down. And meanwhile, what happened was the son of Antiochus, whose name is Seleucus II, this is Callinicus, he ended up rebuilding the army very quickly, and after Ptolemais had to withdraw to deal with his own problems, he went ahead, took back the land that had been captured, but he wasn't able to continue and take over Syria, take over Eretz Yisrael. So Shanini Amor Gozbin, he was able to withstand him for many more years, even after he lost the territory that he was taken. According to some, this is a cosmic statement now about the difference between the king of the north and the king of the south. So what it's saying over here, he will end up being in a position of power longer than the Melech HaTzafon. Why is that? Because the Ptolemaeans ended up remaining over a century independent even after the Romans had taken over the Melech HaTzafon, the Seleucid kingdom, and had turned it into a province of Rome. But Egypt was free until Cleopatra died. So this is the difference between the last king of the Seleucid was Demetrius, and he already lost the kingdom in about 150 BC, and the Ptolemaeus, Cleopatra, only died in about 30, which means that there was over a century of time that he was able to be in a Shanim beyond, above and beyond the Melech HaTzafon. This is how it's had to go and learn, so that we've popped out for a moment, according to him. And now getting back to the story, so now continues the pasuk, Ubal b'malchut Melech HaNegev v'shav el admato. And then he's able to invade the area of the very kingdom of the Melech HaDaron, but he's going to end up going back to his own area. That means that he had recaptured all of these territories that he had lost, but he's going to be forced to go back El Admato in a very horrible defeat, which actually wasn't much of his own fault, because his attempt to invade Mitzrayim was by sea, and he made a great fleet to be able to do that, and everything would have been probably quite successful, except for the unfortunate fact that D-Day was attacked by bad weather, and he ended up losing his navy, and therefore needed to return in a very, very painful defeat. After which, Uvanav Yitgaru, now his children end up fighting among themselves. This is after the Seleucus II died, after coming back from this defeat. And there was a great war in which, indeed, one of his children was killed. And it turns out that Seleucus III, also called Soter, he was the older one, and Antiochus III, who was actually his, Seleucus' little brother, they went together to fight originally, and they went to take back the whole area that was originally part of Alexander's, that was Asia Minor. And afterwards, Seleucus III was killed, and then Antiochus III became now the Melech, and after that, he was called already Antiochus the Great, and he became the king. So this was such massive battle that we call it Vasvu Hamon Chayalim Rabim, that they gathered together tremendous armies, and he came Uba Bo Vishatav Vahabar. He came like a flood to flow over, passing through every place that he went, Vyoshov, and went until the Itgareh Ad Ma'oza, all the way fighting through until the great stronghold. Now, this is a reference to the attack of Antiochus the Great to take back, indeed, Eretz Yisrael, and to take back Syria. Now, by this time, it was the fourth Ptolemy who was the king of the Negev. And his name was Philopater, and he was a grandson of the Ptolemy II who had the Tanakh translated. And actually, he was able at this point to take part of Eretz Yisrael itself. And he actually had taken not only the Syrian area, but had taken the Tzafon of Eretz Yisrael, and he then stopped. Vayit marmar, Melech HaNegev, the king of the south, for a change, will become very mitmarmar, will become very, very bitter. Why did he become bitter? Because this Ptolemaeus IV was a very famous playboy, and the last thing that he wanted to do was to interrupt his fun by needing to go out and fight. And so, but at this point, he got so upset about losing this territory that he actually personally went to discuss things with advisors into charge of the war, went even out to the place of the battle itself and gave speeches, and was able to be Hamid Hamon Rav Vitana Hamon Biado. He raised a tremendous army, and the great army was given over into his hands. So in other words, Antiochus' army was, even though it said before it was a massive army, it was defeated by Ptolemaeus IV. And therefore, Antiochus had to leave, went back to Antioch, and gave up on this conquest. And so, at this point, Menisa Heabon, the Ram Lebabo. So now the great army and the king that was in charge became very, very stuck up about this and felt like elated about their victory and became very proud. They actually persuaded themselves that they had destroyed Antiochus' ability to regroup and to come back. And because of that, Tonius went straight back to being a playboy and was not going to let this little period of war change what it was that he was going to do with his life, which of course was a very, very dangerous thing to do because a completely undefeated Antiochus is a lot more, was angry, bleeding, and hurt. It's a lot more dangerous than just an Antiochus who was hoping to make some new deals and conquer some new territory. And so it's true that he lost tens of thousands, and Antiochus really, really had suffered in this battle, and because of that, they were convinced, Voloyaos, that he will now not be able to be strong against them, because only has one. That wasn't actually the story at all. Indeed, what really happened is that Antiochus the Great came back to attack Mitzrayim. So that it is true that actually the great moment of Ptolemy's IV's life, actually historically, was the way that he was willing to fight against Antiochus the Great and the speeches that he gave, and that was just, however, a very temporary thing. He never ended up becoming strong the way that he might have. And because of that, when Antiochus comes back, there's trouble for Ptolemy's. And so Antiochus regrouped and got an even greater army together than he had the first time. And he did this with a Kitzaitim Shanim at the end of some time, which was years. Again, years may be suggesting too, but in reality, in terms of the history of it, it was 14 years after Ptolemy's victory that Antiochus once again decided to attack the south at this point being Syria, not Mitzrayim. I mean, hopefully he was hoping he would get through Syria or Israel and take Mitzrayim as well. Now, the original Ptolemy that he had fought, Ptolemy IV, was no longer alive at this point, which perhaps was the reason that he was encouraged now to come back. And so, Yavo, Bo, Bechayel, Gadol, Vechushrav, he will come, because we talk about it as if it's going to be, because we talk about it from the point of view of what it was that Anil heard. When I describe what it's referring to, I describe it with the perspective of history, so that it already happened. So here we're talking about the Ptolemy the Fifth. This is Ptolemy Epiphanes, who is actually not the king yet, because he was an infant, and there were regents that were in charge at this time, and he came back with a tremendous war machine, which we refer to as Ruchush. Now, in those days, there were many, many who joined in this battle against the Ptolemy, because as is usual at a time when a regent rules, there is always an opportunity. And it was at this time that Antiochus the Great, he now made all kinds of interesting alliances, one of which was with the king of Macedonia, who was Philip, and most interesting, and here is the first time we have an open involvement of Yisrael with him, Uvinei paritzei ammecha inaseu lahamit hazon v'nechshalo. And the ones of your own people, says Gabriel to Daniel, who are pritzim, they don't keep the mitzvahs the way they should, and they are without any kind of malchus, they are going to now think that they are great, inaseu, they will make themselves great, and they were going to now define the chazon, and that will cause them to be nichshal, which of course, being nichshal, we know is exactly what happens when people are dorish kitzim. And this was the first example that we have of a drisha of the kitz, which allowed them to end up creating tremendous problems for themselves. So they now, some learn that this means that they join now this revolution against Ptolemy, so this is Ptolemy the Fifth, against his region, and they claimed that they had analyzed now the Nevi'ahs of Daniel, and they had seen that this was going to be the end of the Melech Adarom, and there was going to be now a new king that would be a king over them all, and because of that, when it failed, they were wiped out, which is usually what happens to failed revolution. Now, what's interesting is that in the Rambam, it means something very, very different. The Rambam learns that this pasuk is a reference to the early beginnings of Christianity, and although this Rambam does not appear in the Rambam that you will find here on the shelf, it is actually the original Gersa, which was cut out by the censors, obvious reasons, as I read it to you, and you'll see, and it reads as follows. The Rambam talks about in Melachim, he talks about what happens if someone that was assumed to be a Messiah, or the Mashiach, failed. So he first learns that Rabbi Akiva, he thought that Ben Kuziva was the Melach, and that's not a problem. That's not considered to be Doresh, the Kate, at all, because what you do is you do what appears to be correct, Melach, And he continues on to aim, but if it turns out that they fail, and Loyaks Leach Adko, so that he ends up not being able to rebuild the base of Mingus, or Nerag, or he's killed, so then obviously the Adu Hashemzel, Chief Ticholavat Torah. This is not, we made a mistake, this is not the one. And if he was a good guy, he has the same thing as a Melech, but not as the Melech HaMashiach, who is the Dorach Kochav Miyakov, and so on. Why was he there? He was there to see whether people would insist in being Darish the Kate, and or whether they're able to be Makabal the Din and continued being Metzapa for Mashiach. So then, this is Merumas in the Posuk in Daniel, says the Rambam, where it said, Umina Maskilimi Kashru, the great, the smart ones, the wise ones, they will end up failing in the way they're trying to understand the Sukkim, because there needs to be, as we'll see later on this Posuk, in this parak, Ki Olad Lamoed, apparently there was more time. And now, moving on to Christianity, says the Rambam, Af Yeshua Hanotri, the man Yeshua who came from Nazareth, Shidimash Yamashiach, he thought that he was going to be the Messiah. And in the end, Venerag with Beitin, Beitin killed him by giving him over to Rome, and they treated him as a Moriz B'malchut because he called himself the new king of Israel. That man too, Kvarnit Nabebo, Daniel, says the Rambam, Daniel had already spoken about him in the Posek that we are now reading. Shenemar, Uvnei Poritzei Amecha, Yinasu V'amit Chazon, that those who are not Shemer the Dinim, they will pretend to have a vision of a Nevius, and they will fail. And I ask you, says the Rambam, is there a greater failure than this? V'chiesh Mirchol Gadol Mizeh? Can you imagine how ridiculous this is? Shekol HaNeviim Dibru, Shemashiach Goel Yisrael HaMoshiyam, Umekabetz Yitchayim, Umechazek Mitzvotam. Take a look throughout all of the Neviim. What is the Mashiach supposed to achieve? He achieves a Geula. He saves them from the Goyim. He brings them all back to Eretz Yisrael. He's Bechazek them to do more mitzvahs. And what happened with this guy Yeshua? Mizegaram La'Beit Yisrael Bacherav. He has caused the deaths of so many of the Jewish people, to spread them out among the goyim, to make them the most despised people on earth, and instead of being ma'amid mitzvot, on the contrary, la'achalif ha'Torah was because of him, they attempted to make a new testament, and instead to have everybody worship a god other than HaKadosh Baruch. So even though now this is like before, really, the Roman, this is still, we're talking about Yovan over here, it's not necessarily that that is a contradiction, because It's certainly mashma from the Gemara that there was a Talmud of Yehoshua ben Parachia, and Yehoshua ben Parachia was around at the time of the Hashmonaim, which is mamish the period that we're talking about, and that he had a Talmud that was called Yeshua, and it gives us all the descriptions of him, and very may well be that the earliest roots of what the Romans have come to identify as the movement in Rome was actually at the time of the Yevanim, during this period of Antiochus, and during this period even that we're celebrating very soon, Now, the Gemara has a whole beautiful story. The story of the Gemara about the coming of Alexander to Israel is a famous story, which has to do with Megillat Ta'anit. Since I still have Megillat Ta'anit, because all that we were interested there was the special day that was called Yom HaGrizim, which was the 20th day of Tevet. Because that's the important part in the Gemara, it doesn't give over all of the details of the interaction of Shimon HaTzadik with Alexander the Great. It gives over some of the details. The story is also brought by Josephus. And interestingly enough, he adds that what it was that they showed to Alexander was the new. And that they showed Alexander how his entire victory had been predicted by Daniel, and that all of these visions were him. And he was very, very moved, especially because, of course, of the whole story of his having had dreams, how ironic, of his having had dreams of Shimon HaTzadik. Now, Shimon HaTzadik, the whole thing is so strange, because Shimon HaTzadik was the Ish Lavush Habadim on earth. And this Gabriel was, the Malach was Lavush Habadim. So listen, this story is an amazing story. So the Gemara talks about the 20th of Tevet, which is the day, it's called Yom HaGrizim, it's Gemara Yuma. And there's a takuna of Megillat Ta'anit, that's a holiday and you're not allowed to give a spade on that day and so on. What was that? The Kutim had approached Alexander, and they wanted the Beit HaMikdash destroyed. And he was taken by them. They told him all kinds of stories that the Jews had invaded. It was really Kutim territory, and after all, were the original Palestinians. And one of these guys, and they built their temple, and it's a very dangerous place, and it's been known to foment rebellions. And if you help us, we'll get rid of them. So he bought into it. So they came, they came to tell Shimon HaTzadik about Ma'asar Shimon HaTzadik. He was Lavash B'gdei Kuna. Here he is, looking like the Malach. V'nitatet B'gdei Kuna. And he takes along with him Yakirei Yerushalayim. And they're carrying Avukot Shel Or. They're carrying these torches of light. And they're going all night long, and the Greeks are on the other side. The Greeks ask the Kutim that are with them, so what is that all about? He said, oh, those are the Jews who we're talking about. They're the ones who have been fomenting rebellions over here. They finally meet. The moment that he sees Shimon HaTzadik, he gets off of the royal chariot, Yerabi Merkavto, and he bows down flat on his face to Shimon HaTzadik. Everybody starts, what's going on? Melach Shekavotcha, Mishtachavu, Mishtachavel Yehudi, is there someone, a great king like you, should bow down to this Jew? Amar Lehem, you guys have no idea. Whenever I go to war, I have a vision of this picture of this man who's leading the army and winning the wars for me. So, d'muti u'gnoshal zeh min atzachah v'fanai v'beit milchamti. This is amazing, man. So it ties together the visions of Daniel with the visions of Alexander. And it's so fascinating because that whole idea of the chamudot atav, that this is Alexander also. He won b'keach, that youthfulness and so on, that became the vision of Yavan, which became the vision of course, is the expression, the vision of Yosef, the terms of Yisrael, the youthful Kennedy idea of Nitzach HaMimachama. So he says to them, so why did you come to meet me? So Shimon HaTzadik says to him, well, we have a special bayit where we're able to be misfollowed for you and for the success of your malchus and for the success of your kingdom. And he's Merames Shalote Charev. So in Josephus, it says that they showed him Sefer Daniel. And over there, it says this horrible news that he's going to be destroyed just as he's most successful. So they're telling him that they are attempting to deal with this problem. And they're davening in the Beis HaMikdash for him. But incredibly, there are these Kutim who are doing their best to destroy that Beit HaMikdash because they really want Alexander ruined. So these Kutim now are telling you to be Machrim, and you're telling them, okay, after all we've done for you. He says, who are we talking about? Good point. These guys. Ela Kutim, Shomdim Lefanecha. So he says to them, whatever you guys want, do with them. So they drilled a hole through their feet, tied them to the horses, and were dragging them along as they were going all the way to Har Gerizim. They come up to Har Gerizim, and with the help of the Greeks, Harashu, Vizaru, Karshidim, the Kedar Shabikshu Lazoto Beit Eloheinu. So they completely destroyed Har Gerizim. They uprooted everything there. The Otayom Masaru Yom Tov. And that day became the Yom Tov of the 20th day of Tevet, which became known as Yom Har Gerizim. So again, the additional story is just amazing that they actually showed him the words that we were just reading in Sefer Daniel. Which, he played such a role, Alexander in Sefer Daniel. It must have made an amazing impression on him. Especially if they pointed out that he's having these visions that are very related to what it was that Daniel himself is seeing. So this was the idea at this time, was the Uvenefrit say Amchas. It was all during this period that, according to the Gemara, this is linked to the early beginnings of Christianity, in which they were Yinasu La'amit Chazon V'nichshalu. But others learned that it means that there were these Jews that attempted now to analyze these psukim and to show that now was the time to be Megala the Kates. And in the end, they failed. And there was no real basis for it, and as we saw, it's an issue to do that. And this is one of the reasons that many of them were killed. Now, as we pointed out yesterday, it's very difficult to understand what all of this discussion of things that took place in the past and absolutely nothing to do with us, what possible meaning there could be in it, and why it's necessary for us to go into all of these details. But, and the truth is, it gets even worse when we find that various Mefarshim see the details as being referring to completely different things, stretching from, on the one hand, reference to Antiochus, on the other hand, a reference to the Hashmonaim, on the other hand, a reference to the Romans, on the other hand, a reference to Constantinople. I mean, it just obviously cannot be meant in terms of a reference to this or that if everybody has completely different approaches to what this or that is. And as the Evan Ezra puts it over here, what he says is, look, there really is no point at all
about referring to the old history book. His Lordship has l'chapesa svarim akadmonim, to go look back in the old books. Even if we understood every last detail, he's referring to a specific event. It wouldn't help us anything now to understand that which has already passed. About kena farish amidot v'tamim b'derech klal, I'll give you a general sense, just in terms of the words and the overall pattern of understanding. And when we get to the point of discussing Acher Churban HaBayit, then it's nogea alas, and then I will start being the farish derech prat. So now he starts his own approach, which is really not to care so much. And the truth is that there are two ways of making something confused. One is by not giving enough information, and one is by giving too much information. My father, Zechron Lavrov, always used to say, the Maharal, the way that he was seisim as Devarav, is by talking so much, and by being so apparently repetitious, and by driving you so crazy with what appears to be the same words over and over again without very specific antecedents. That was his approach to actually creating confusion, and to being gonies and sote, the things that weren't meant to be discussed openly. And if that's the case, then Daniel may be taking here that approach as well. Like one way to be so tame is to give over too much detail that cannot be explained. But the truth is, if we take a look, we mentioned yesterday the Rambam, I'd like to actually read this Rambam to you. We didn't have it handy yesterday. I'd like to read it to you now from the Sefer to see what it is that he talks about. And listen to the gears of the Rambam. However, Kodesh Baruch Hu's makshavot are not similar to ours. And you have to understand that kol advarim ha'elu shel Yeshua Nutri, all of the events that take place because of this Yeshua Nutri, and that crazy Yishmaelite, Shomer Acharav, who came after him. All of these guys, Einan, Emel, Yesher, Derech, LaMelech HaMashiach. They are all necessary steps on the way to a successful Mashiach. And they are part of the Tikkun of the world to be Eved Hashem together. And how is that? Says the Rambam, because of these guys, the whole world is full of discussions about a Messiah. They're beginning to get a concept of Geula. And because of that, they've examined the Torah, Midivrei HaTorah, Midivrei HaMitzvot, Upashtut Vorin Elo Diyim Rechokim, even to the furthest islands, where Amim Rabim Arle Lev, nations that had never heard anything about monotheism, about the concept of creation that was meant to achieve, about the coming of a Geula. And all of these people who know nothing about anything are now deeply involved in their theology, in Dosim, in Otim Midvorim Elo, Uve Mitzvot HaTorah, and they're arguing, some of them say mitzvot they were meant, but maybe they were botul bezman hazeh, and they weren't meant for dorot, and some of them saying no, that's dorim nistorim, and it's also hidden things that are discussed here in these mitzvot, but they're not meant to be literal, and the einam kipshutan, and the Messiah already came, and he was megala, the real meaning, that it doesn't mean to do this act, it means something that is mystical, and magical, and spiritual, and that's what we need to do. So, fine, however it is that they view this is irrelevant, because when Malchut is finally truly achieved, the Yatzliach, the Aron, the Yinaseh, and will be successful, and will end up now uplifted, everyone will see the truth. Miyad, kulam chozrim, v'yodim, shesheker, nechalu, avotehem, v'sheneviehem, v'avotehem, hitum, that they've been fooled by their false prophets, and by their parents' religious belief, and will immediately be capable of identifying their mistake. Whereas if we had to start from scratch with people who had no concept of anything, but their own primitive theologies and religions, then indeed we would have absolutely nothing at all. And it's clear that, according to the Rambam, something very profound is being achieved by these visions, and that is that ultimately, because of them, and because of their attractiveness to interpretation to the Umay Sa'ilam, in which, if you take a look at Christianity, I mean, apocalyptic literature, I mean, the amount of art and discussions, and the Antichrist, and all of the issues that revolve around the Book of Revelations, and the relationships that they make of it to Daniel, and the way they take the visions of Daniel and attempt to apply it, and that is the ultimate, B'nai Pritzei Amra, that is the ultimate attempt to hamid chazon. B'nech shalom. The chazon in its keshal, however, says the Rambam, has actually paved the way in the most remarkable fashion by using literature, imagination, and myth to to break through the ignorant and the complete lack of concern for future, for Geula, for Reishis, and has made the most primitive nations on earth sensitive to the concept of a future to come, and the idea of a Tikkun HaOlam, and the meaning of true Malchus, so that if that's the case, we can view this detailed parak here as another sign of the way in which the initial vision gave over the sense of the buildup of Malchus, which has become so much a part of human society. If we take a look at the nested order of Malchus, we walk into the British Museum, and the sense of a Maida Malchus, in which Malchus becomes so powerful that all of the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar, and the massive bovel, which was his great belief in himself, and a tower, and a statue entirely of gold, becomes a room in a museum, picked stone by stone, brick by brick, taken away from Bavel and brought into the Malchus Edom. That all of the dreams of Sancheret should be taken out of his living room and put into a place in the British Museum. Whether it's in Berlin or whether it's currently in actually Babylonia's in the British Museum, but all of the idea of Esau, the fact that the greatest of the Malchias that once were are now represented by a subdivision of a museum in which one can walk through the rooms, the bedrooms, the living rooms of the greatest of the Malachim, in which their very bodies reside as things to be looked at in the hands of the greatest of all the Malachim, the Malachim's Edom. That concept of growing Malachim, the immense power that one can feel going into a place like this and watching the architecture, the immensity of the building, the way in which all is dwarfed compared to the new sense of the international, totally international, planet-wide awareness of what human civilization is capable of. This is awesome. And it is a result, says the Rambam, ultimate, of the built up on the one hand of the nested Malchus, one above the other, in which the greatest of all comes from the very earth in its emergence, and the fact that there was a vision that gave off so much information that it could be misused by everyone all through history. The Amit Chazon, and in that very misuse, ends up becoming more valuable. So all of the various things that we learned yesterday, all of the various details, indeed may very well not be important. Whether we're going to follow the approach of Rashi that we're talking about, the Chashmon Noyim, or about following the approach of the Malbah that we're talking about, the various Seleucid or Ptolemyan detailed interrelationships, or whether this is even a description on a very primitive level of a certain yin-yang humanity, which becomes the north and the south and the poles, in which Eretz Yisrael is the nexus and the focus, things here change. And we need to focus on what those changes are. Ultimately, this is the story of a developing Yisrael in completely new context that includes Hanukkah here with Yavan, that include Purim earlier with a completely new approach to what a Binyan Beit HaMikdash could be, and all within the context of a vision of the Neil, which allows a Beit HaMikdash to be a trial, and which sees the very Binyan HaBayit not as a Geula, but rather as a step towards Geula, a trial run to test out the various possibilities of Yisrael's vision. And so as we continue through this parak, it's important to recognize that whether the details are one or the details of the other or the details are none is relatively unimportant. What we're going to need to start looking for are the patterns of behavior in which Yisrael is impacted and changed. And after whatever it is that these various interrelationships imply with Bnei Prit Hayom Chaim, with many of the other Rabbim Yamdu, what happened was that Ve'yavo Melech HaTzafon, after now he made all of these alliances, so Antiochus comes now as king of the north, V'yishpoch Solalah, and he throws up now, Solalah is usually translated as siege work, a battery, and this is the time that Antiochus didn't even have to fight. He just floods through, comes completely through Syria, and what was called southern Syria, in order to make people forget the name of Eretz Yisrael, it was really a reference to Eretz Yisrael, and he gets all the way up to Gaza. And there, indeed, was the first time that he was fought against, and it was after the siege that's referring to here, of the Sulalah against Gaza, that he was Valachad Ir Mivzarot, that he ended up now capturing that fortified city, and that was it. Ro'ot HaNegev Lo Yamodu, the arms of the south, it used to be called the armed force, right? Ro'ot HaNegev, the arms of the south, will not be able to stand any longer. So even though Lamaisa, again, historically speaking, there was a period there at Gaza that things looked good for the people from the south, south of the Atolbias. And that's because they actually got a mercenary. And there was this general from Yovan, whose name was Scopas. And he actually began fighting to capture Erzisrael. And again, the whole thing revolved around Erzisrael. But at the Pamias, which is where the Yarden comes from, that's where he was destroyed. And the entire army was left, the Sacha Kor, with only 10,000 people. And he was he tried to withdraw to Sidon, and there again he was attacked by Antiochus. And so he was in good shape at that point, and it followed that then the army of Harav would also be included. This was now a reference to the ones that he had chosen, and that means that the Mitzrayim again, the Ptolemyon, sent another army. Again, we're reading an awful lot into the Pasuk, but again, in the way the Malbim understands the relationship to general history, we can do this. So what happened at that point is that Ptolemyon sent another army to try to relieve the siege against Sidon, and they also were defeated directly, and the continued siege of Sidon led to the surrender of the army together with the general Scopas, and that would mean, if that's the meaning, then it means they didn't have strength to stand up against him. Again, it's speaking over here as if it already happened. What we're talking about as if it already happened from the point of the historical perspective. The Malach is talking about what will be. And so Vayas Haba Elav, the one who will come to him, is going to end up doing, in other words, Antiochus, who ended up here in the middle of the area that used to belong to Ptolemy. He will do whatever he wants, care to know, he will take over the entire Syria, and the important part is that he will stand by Yamod Be'eretz Hatzaviv V'Chalabiyad. He will stand in the land of desire. We've already seen that Eretz Hatzvi, of course, on a simple level, is referred to the land of the greatest Shevach, the Mu'ula, was the Yeshivas Haminim, it was the land that we say brachas for, the land that HaKadosh Baruch was Mishabeach. But here, the use of it as the prize among all of the campaigns back and forth here, to talk about Eretz Tzvi and how it goes back and forth, caught between the north and the south, so that it becomes the focus, the nexus of all of this issue here. He stood now in Eretz Tzvi that he desired, and this way we can understand the nature of Antiochus as wanting to be in Yerushalayim. He captured indeed Eretz Yisrael, including even all the way up, even including the Sinai, up to Mitzrayim, V'chala b'yadon. And now he had all the power in his hand. If he wanted to, he could have destroyed the whole country. Nobody could have stood against him at all. Now, Rashi learns that he actually did the Chol HaBiyadot, but that means that it was not referring to the same Antiochus that we were referring to before. In other words, this means the one who will come afterward, and then it would be referring to, starting from before till now, to Antiochus the Fourth. And that was the one who indeed started up against Yisrael at time of Hanukkah, and that would be what we would be referring to here according to Rashi. But it's difficult to believe it's a reference to the same Antiochus that was us in Kiratono, if it's referring to the same man who had invaded, and that was Antiochus III. So it could be that maybe there's a new Nevi'ah over here. And this is how Rashi understands. Vayas Habaylov, there will be one who will then come. In other words, after Antiochus III takes over the Eretz Tzvi, there will be somebody who will come who will see that as what he wants to maintain and to hold. And he caused tremendous annihilation. That would be the Chol HaVayado. Not that he could have caused had he wished, but ended up instead being favorable towards Eretz Tzvi. In the Malbim, it's much more that the Chol simply means the whole thing. So at Vachola, he completed now the entire Milchama against Eretz Yisrael. That means that he had finally been Zoche in all of Eretz Yisrael. V'yasim panav, and then he turned himself to going ahead, lavo betokev kol malchuto, to go ahead and to penetrate the very depth and the primal beginnings of the Melech Hadaron, to be able to take over the Ptolemyos area completely, and to do now what it had always been his desire, to create one unified Melucha. But instead, the Yesharim Imo, instead, they decided to reach some kind of peace treaty. And the reason that this happened, it's strange, is that he had everything in his hands. Why was there a peace treaty? Because this was the time that the Romans, who were getting stronger and stronger in the background, got very worried about this new Antiochus' ability to set up something that resembled the original Greek Empire, which would be in indeed a threat to Rome. And so they actually sent an emissary to work out a peace treaty, and meanwhile giving the clear-cut indication to Antiochus that if he didn't make peace, then there was going to be war with Rome, which apparently Antiochus was not willing to do, at least not at this time. And so what happened was that Antiochus made a peace agreement, and they did the same thing that the first peace agreement was built on, and that is they would join to the marriage of daughter. And therefore here, instead of Phoneus giving his daughter to Antiochus, Antiochus gave his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy. By this point, this is Ptolemy the Fifth, and he relied on his daughter to actually be the one who would manage to, from within, get Mitzrayim and give it over to him, to Antiochus. And the agreement, therefore, was, continues the Pasuk, Ubat Anashim Yitenlo, he will give him the daughter of the woman, and all of this will be La'ashchita, which is meant to destroy the Ptolemy kingdom. V'lo ta'amod, but that plan didn't work out very well. V'lo lo tiyeh, she wasn't going to be loyal to him. She ended up being loyal to her husband, interestingly enough, and because of that, she did the opposite of what he wanted her to do, and Cleopatra was therefore loyal to Ptolemy and helped out Ptolemy. Now again, according to Rashi, this works out as being the story of Hanukkah, because he's learning that we're referring to Antiochus IV. So he learns V'yisharim. Doesn't mean V'yisharim to make peace. Peace, V'yisharim means V'yisharim, meaning Klal Yisrael, the ones that were Dovuk to Hashem, they are Yisharim, and therefore it's a reference to the B'nai Hashmonai. So V'yisharim imo, they will join up, and now this way it continues the B'nai Pritzei Amcha. So the Pritzei Amcha are now the ones who are the opposite of the Yisharim, the Amcha, and the Yisharim, the Hashmonaim, will join up with the king of the south now, and then the Bat Hanashim, this is a reference to Klal Yisrael, as Bat Nadiv. This, the Bat Hanashim, the beautiful Klal Yisrael, which we refer to as all through Shir Hashirim, as Dodati, so that Bat Hanashim will give the daughter of the woman, meaning the Bnei Yisrael, the ones who are loyal, they will attempt to destroy her. But V'lo ta'amod, this is not going to work because the Hashmonaim will be able to destroy Antiochus. So according to this, we're already holding the way Rashi's learning in a description of Yesharim versus Pritim, of the value of what it is that B'nai Hashmonai did in terms of Malchus Yisrael versus the destruction of those who attempted to influence world events through the issues of Christianity or manipulating Alexander. And so then, Vayasim panav le'igim v'lachad rabim. Then he will turn his face towards the island. And this makes a great deal of sense if it was a way in which he was going to undermine Rome, because what he started to do now is fight against the Iyim, and includes the Greek islands, it includes Carthage, and this was, of course, the main problem that Rome had. So he ended up taking over areas that were very dangerous to Rome, because now he was already in Greece, and he was in the islands of the Mediterranean, and he actually, again, in terms of history, he crossed over and he recaptured. Now, he crossed the Dardanelles. He ended up taking over the area that we call now that on the other side of the Dardanelles, the European area of Turkey. This is the whole basis of the desire of Turkey now to join with the European Union. So it was a question, what exactly is Turkey? Is it part of the people in the West, or is it part now of the Malchut that we're talking about here? And at this point, he is ready now to take a chance at fighting Rome also. And because of that, he becomes very stuck up. Because he is Lachad Rabin, he ends up conquering many of these. But v'yishvit katzin cherpatolo milti cherpato yashivo. Yeah, but there's going to be a general, or a katzin, a important representative, who will get him to stop being so high and mighty. And this is actually a reference to the Roman who was sent by the Roman Senate to fight Antiochus, and this was the famous Battle of Thermopylae. And over there, the entire fleet was destroyed, and he had to run back, cross again the Dardanelles, and try to protect what it is that he had gained to prevent the Romans from taking everything that was his. What actually happened is, though, that then the Romans, and they were at this point, they were being led by Lucius and Publius, and they destroyed, in the end, Antiochus, and destroyed him absolutely, I mean, completely. The entire army was wiped out. And that taught him, and this, just for his chutzpah, he will now get it back to him, and he was punished. So that means all of the things that were taken away, and was only for one reason. He could have gotten away with what he was doing if he had only handled himself with greater politic. And all he needed to do was not threaten Rome. And so when it turned out that in the end, Antiochus Antiochus had to accept whatever terms were given him. Not only did he have to give up all of what he had conquered here that was dangerous to Rome, he forced him to actually pay reparations. An amazing thing. And that was because, specifically, he had this level of chutzpah, gaiva, not to recognize that the times were changing and that Rome was coming. According to Rashi, this means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu punished him by killing him in a horrible way. So therefore, he learns that when it says, Vishbir Katzin Cherpatolo, it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was the one who took the cherpa, meaning the chutzpah of the blasphemy, that he used to be Mecharev HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he used to be Mecharev Klal Yisrael. And Rashi brings this from Yosefon, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu punished him with this horrible shechin that was all over him while he was on the way to Yerushalayim, until he actually rotted, his body rotted while he was living, and he couldn't even get the people that were his servants to bring him back to Antukia. Nobody wanted to even go near him. It was a horrible thing. And this was his punishment for the way that he had lifted his hand against Yerushalayim. So that's a completely different approach than the historical one that we're taking as being part of the Greek-Roman confrontation. So we continue now the way that we were understanding it. So then in Pasuk Yotet, it would be referring to how he came about to his end. Where was he killed? Vayoshev Banav Lobu Uzeyarzo. Because now he had to pay these very, very high reparations. So where was he going to get that? So he went back to his own place, which was the original Syria, and he wanted them to pay for everything, and he did something that was very dumb. He went to Elam, and he took the kachim that had been given to the Avodah Zarah Baal, and they actually, when they heard about it, the people in town killed him. And Velo Yimatzei, and he was never found again. And of course, those who learned that it's a reference to his body decaying while he was yet alive means he wasn't even buried. There was nothing left up. So and so then what happened was that Omad Alkano, now there is someone of Omad Alkano on the stand where Antiochus III was, if we learn this way, we've been learning, not that it was a reference to Antiochus IV, now arrives in to Lucius IV, Philip Peter, and there was, again, he had faced the same problem of needing to pay a tremendous amount of money in war reparations to the Romans, and, I mean, not to mention the fact that there was tremendous taxes already because of all of the campaigns that Antiochus III had been carrying on for all of the time, and so the great gedula of the next king, we'll tell you what it was. It was the Ma'avir Nogei, the guy whose greatest fame for his kingdom was that he managed to raise taxes. And in a few years he would be broken. And it wouldn't be through any attack from the outside, and it wouldn't be through any major rebellion against them. It was simply the assassination. Heliodorus, his own guy, assassinated him, and basically it was a completely meaningless period, a meaningless malchus that achieved nothing but the rise in taxes. Now, of course, according to Rashi, we are now dealing with the same person. So how could it say the Amad al-Kano? Therefore, Rashi understands that the whole time we've been talking about Antiochus IV, even before. So when it says that they will come now, the Amad al-Kano, that is referring to the Chashmonaim. And this is referring to Matisyo Kain Gadol, who will be Ma'avir Nogeis, who will get rid, and this is the Rambas, these are the words that we use actually in most Sur, he will get rid of the one who is the Nogeis, Uva Nogeis. That Nogeis now is Antiochus IV. And that is, once again, the way the Rambam defines it is the restoration of Malchus Yisrael for all those years. That is Hedera Malchut. That is the glory of Malchus for Klal Yisrael, as the Rambam puts. But unfortunately, and in no time at all, the Chashmonaim will be mamish broken. How will they be broken? Not through Apayim, not through Milchama, in other words, not with anything that has to do with anyone else, but instead through the absurd, constant arguing between the brothers Hyrcanus and Aristobulus about politics, which will end up destroying them completely. All this because, as Ramban points out, the Malchus cannot be had by anyone but Shevet Yehuda, and by not willing to reconstruct Malchus Yisrael as it was meant to be, the Chashmonaim lost the right to the Schus that they had won. Now, if we go back to the way in which we were learning it, not like Rashi, and that it was V'amad al-Kano, that was the brief reign of Seleucus IV, who was now the son of Antiochus III, and who accomplished absolutely nothing, now comes a far more insidious king. V'amad al-Kano, and then standing in the foundation that had come from before of the original Antiochus, comes now a disgusting person, a nivzeh. No one had had given him the glory of the kingdom, because after Seleucus IV died, he did not leave a king. Instead, what happened was that, as was the wont in those times, and we've learned about this before, and we saw that it was done even by kings of Yisrael, he died with a son who could have become the melech, and his name was Demetrius. That Demetrius, the Romans were holding, and they held him in hostage to Seleucus' behavior and paying of his war reparation. But there was a baby son, and that baby son's name was Antiochus, and he was the son of Seleucus IV. However, there was a very unavuncular uncle whose name was Antiochus, who was not supposed to be the king, and what he did, this Antiochus, was to become Antiochus IV, not a son of Seleucus IV, but rather a uncle then of the correct king, the legitimate king, Uba Bishalva. He came pretending to be concerned only for peace, Bechazik Malchut Bachalaklakot, and he ended up stealing away the Malchus through trickery. So this was a complex story, which is not 100% clear, but it seems if you take a look at the coins, the original coins that Antiochus coined, Antiochus IV, it appears that he never calls himself king initially. So in other words, he was supposed to be the regent, the kindly uncle. He was going to take care of his young baby nephew. How did he manage to even get into this position? But the truth is that he wasn't even around at the time that his brother had died. And he was really part of the Roman. The reason he was part of the Romans is because he too had been taken as a hostage. And that was at the time that his father's own father had been defeated by the Romans. And because of that, nobody was going to support him as king back in the old city, meaning back in Syria, in his area. And what he did was he convinced now one of the Roman supporters to allow him to use troops to go into Antioch and to basically create a revolutionary government, and then to pretend that he would only do this in order to protect the son now of Seleucus. Now, the good regent was away fighting, and he was fighting a rebellion, actually. And while he was away, the Antiochus, who was the son of Seleucus IV, was murdered. And Antiochus came back. He was able to smell like a rose by killing the murderers and seeing to it that they were punished, and thereby completely, legally, becoming the king. And then these are all the arms that sweep will actually end up swept away by him and be broken, even including the Gam Nagid Brit, even including the one who is the nobleman of the Brit itself. Now, this Brit, most learned, is a reference to the treaty. This was the treaty that had been made now. This was Ptolemaeus the VI at this point, and this was already the son of Antiochus' sister, Cleopatra, if you remember. They had made now an agreement to keep the peace, and Ptolemaeus the V had died. Cleopatra was left with only children, and she became now the queen. And Antiochus, because of the fact that he was the brother of the regent, who was the queen, Cleopatra, he used that to be welcomed into Egypt itself. And once he was there, then he became the one who was able to sweep away those by taking advantage of the trickery to take over Egypt. Not everyone agrees that it was all so nasty. Actually, there is another approach, which has it that only after Cleopatra died, then did Antiochus take over. And the way that he took over was by claiming that the Egyptians were planning on taking over Eretz Israel again. And, of course, this was now already in the hands of the Northern Kingdom, which, as we mentioned earlier, was very, very open to the Roman dominion. And because of that, the Romans, who were at war at the time, wouldn't do anything to undermine what Antiochus was claiming. And they went ahead and allowed him to fight. And it was at that point that he was able to take over Mitzrayim. This was the approach that we've been taking. Now, remember, according to Rashi, we're talking over here nothing to do with the story of the Antiochus, who had been king a long time before. He understands the Negid Brit is referring now to the Jews once again, because remember, he was talking about the Hashmonaim. So according to him, this was all about the Hashmonaim, and they had made a Brit, meaning a Brit with Rome. And as the Gemara says in Avodah Zarah, that the Romans had originally darshan l'isav and elchor v'chol negdecha, and they kept that bris for 26 years. And after that, they no longer kept the bris because they were derish in terms of the spiritual element of it. They were derish v'yavar na'adoni l'fnei avdo. So again, according to Rashi, we're talking over here about the takeover of Rome. in which case the idea of the Zerot HaShetef, the ones that used to be the flood, that was a reference to Greece itself and to all of the various sections of Greece. So the strength of Malchus Yavan, which used to be the ones that were Shatef the entire world, they will become Nishtaf in front of the Romans. Not a reference to Antioch, but rather in front of the Romans. And even in the Gid Brit, where the Romans had been very Mechabed, the Malchus of Israel, and they had a Brit that they would be remain independent, in the end, they too didn't keep that Brit, and that's a reference to the end of the 26 years, which they were no longer Komu Onavatayo Bahadi Yisrael. So he learns, he continues then, Uminit Chabrut Elav Yasemirma. Because those who wanted to be Mishtatef with Rome, so those that had been Mishaber to him, meaning in Am Yisrael, they had made so many agreements with him, he was completely the Rama here, did not let them see in advance that the intent was to take over completely. And instead, the Alav Yatsan de Ma'atgo, he utilized the Eretz Yehuda itself, he utilized the soldiers and the support of Yisrael to go up and with very few of his own soldiers, Biba'atgoi, without needing to bring out legions from Rome, he was able to take over the entire area around Eretz Yisrael and in the end to become now the master of the entire Syria, Eretz Yisrael, and so on. And therefore, B'shalvah, B'mishmane, Medina Yavo, V'yasa, Shelo Asur Avotav, V'yavot Avotav, Biza, V'shalal, U'rechush Lehem Yivzor, V'yam Yivzorim Yichashev Machshavotav, V'yadet. And so, in peace, into the most lacrime de lacrime, the Mishmane, the richest parts of the entire country, he will come to achieve what his fathers and their fathers before them could never achieve. And he will spread all types of bribes among them, all the booty that he could, all the spoils of war, all of his own wealth from the years. And he will concentrate his force, his thoughts, in other words, against the areas that were most critical and crucial to be ready v'ad eight until the time that he could use his presence against them. And all of this was done without letting on to the fact that he was planning the ultimate war. Now, what this ad eight means depends on which approach we take. It's according to the Malman's approach. And everything that we were talking about up until now was what Antiochus was doing during the time that Cleopatra was still around. And then at that, according to that, he didn't do anything at that time itself. Ad eight would mean that he was back at home until the time came when Cleopatra died that he would be able to attack now Eretz Mitzrayim in order to be able to take over, which was always his dream. But if you learn the other approach we've been taking here, which is that this is already referring to his own attack in Eretz Mitzrayim, so then Ad 8 just means that he was waiting for the manpower that he needed to be able to complete the attack. And obviously it was going to take a long time until he would have his supply lines ready and be sure that he'd be able to continue the fight in the inside depths of Mitzrayim itself. Now this also changes, depending which approach we take, it changes the meaning of the next pasuk. V'ya'er kocho v'vo'al melech ha-negev. And so he rose up very, very much with his power and with his full heart against the king of the south, b'chayel gadol, he had a large army, u'melech ha-negev yitkare ala milchama b'chayel gadol v'yatsumad la'od. But the melech of the south got extremely upset and came out now to fight with him with a very great army, very powerful army. Nonetheless, lo yamod ki yachshavu alav machshavot, but he was unable to withstand, or will be unable to withstand again from the point of view of the malach in the past, will not be able to withstand because yachshavu alav machshavot, they have all types of serious plans against him. So now, once again, depending on how we learn, we're going to have two different approaches. So if we learn that he hadn't yet arrived at the time that Cleopatra died, so then this means vayer kocho, after her death. If we learn that it's talking about while he was in Mitzrayim, when this was happening, then this refers to the wars that took place against Antiochus, which was in Alexandria. They decided to fight against him, and they made Ptolemy already the seventh by this time, the king, and they said that Antiochus has no place here, despite his family ties, and he then attacked Alexandria. That's what I've been referring to. The Melech HaNegev, again, either is referring to the way we just learned Ptolemy as the seventh, or it was still Ptolemy the sixth, if it's referring back to the approach that he hadn't yet really invaded Mitzrayim. So, Yachshavu Alav Machshavot, of course, would also be a different approach. Yachshavu Alav Machshavot means that the Ptolemy, if it's referring to the sixth, and not to Alexandria. So that means that Antiochus had bribed his way against Ptolemy, which is actually what had happened. And because of that, his own army had turned against him. According to the other pshat that it's referring to Alexandria, it means that Alexandria's resistance is not going to be able to continue because, again, here too, Yachshav Machshavot was that Antiochus had seen to it that the governor of Cyprus, which at that time was part of the Negev, he joined up with Antiochus, and because of that, they were basically conquered. Now remember, we also had the earlier pshat, which was Rashi's pshat, that this is referring to the whole Cheshmonaim period. And then according to Rashi, this was referring to the way that Rome had attacked, during the time of Hyrcanus, had attacked Eretz Mitzrayim. So in greater detail, what was the Machshavot cause? That the Ochlei Papago Yishburu, the very ones who were dependent on his food, assuming that it's referring to Ptolemy the Sixth and his own army that broke with him, so they will destroy him. Even though they were supposed, should have been loyal to him, in the end they accepted now the bribes that were given to Antiochus. And because of that, Antiochus will be able to wipe away, or flood away now, his army. And this is because it was like a blitzkrieg. So that will be the end of the army of the south. Ushnehem Amalachim, and the two kings. Now again, if this is talking about the good region, what happened was is that Antiochus actually captured his own nephew, and that was the Ptolemy's estate. And meanwhile, as we talked about the Alexandrians, they had gone ahead and made the younger brother, the seventh king, and Antiochus promised them that, you know, all they need to do is accept his nephew, the original Ptolemy, as king, and then he doesn't want to hurt anybody. He's only trying to protect his beloved nephew. But the truth is, levavam lemerah, l'shulchan echad kazav yedaberu. But actually, both of them have very bad hearts. In other words, they were both planning to destroy the other. And they're sitting there together, each one of them lying to the other. Obviously, we don't know precisely what the plans might have been. And there are those who suggest that maybe he was hoping, Antiochus, that the whole country would descend into a civil war, which would allow him to do what he wanted. But in any event, the Pasuk tells us, Lotitzlach, whatever plan it was, is not going to succeed. And what happened was, indeed, the opposite of what he had planned. The two brothers ended up joining up and going out to fight Antiochus himself. Ki ot keitz lamoed, for there is yet time that needs to be waited until the end comes. And this means that this was near the time of the end of Malchus Yavan. This is where we're coming down to the very, very last years. And remember, according to Rashi, we're talking about during the time of the Chashmonaim, then the two kings are not referring at all to Antiochus in the story of Ptolemy, but rather the two kings, according to him, was Hyrcanus, who was in the middle of his fight with Aristobulus, and this, of course, led to the Korban ultimately, because he called in the Romans to help him out, and there was Pompeius. Pompeius was not a king, but according to Rashi, that's what it's referring to here. He was a general, but he was the governor that was the representative of Rome, and because of that, both of them are viewed here, even though it's horrible to say this about Hyrcanus, both of them were interested in doing harm, so that's Mahara, to Claudius Rome, because whether it was in terms of the Roman determination to take over, whether it was in terms of Hyrcanus and his willingness to risk everything just to be able to be Melech, they're both considered to be Rishayim here. Nonetheless, as it says over here, it's not going to be successful. Why? Because, remember that before in Perek Tet, we saw that there were supposed to be 62 weeks yet, meaning 62 times 7, number of years. That means that we needed to have the full amount of the 420 years for the Basic English to stand in order to get the full total of the years from that time. And those years had not yet been finished. So when we say, Ot Keitz Amoreid, we're saying it was already a commitment to the 420 years of the Beit HaMikdash, the Binyan Sheni. And so, Antiochus went back to the north, taking along with him a tremendous amount of spoils, Rechush Gadol, but in his heart, what he really wanted was a Levavo Brit Kodesh. He was up against the real Brit, not the local Brit that we talked about before, but the Brit with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which of course is also a reference to Brit Milah, and this then would cause them to be geyser against Brit Milah. And what he really wanted to do was to take over, and not only take over physically, but to take over in terms of Malchut Yavan by causing the Hellenization of Eretz Yisrael. This was so important to them that it became, again, if you take a look in the dictionary, the concept of Hellenization, Hellenized, or Hellenist, is related specifically to Yisrael, even though in a very general sense they're a Hellenist of any nation, but it was their intent, the only ones, just like to us, the only ones that represented, of all the nations, a challenge that was an intellectual challenge to Yisrael,
which for the first time we meet people who have the vision of understanding the world, of caring about what life means, philosophy and science and insight into an examined life and doing teshuva from the point of view of human centrality. The same thing was true, of course, of the Yevonim. And to them, the original conquests were conquests of barbarians. The people who couldn't think, couldn't talk, had no connection to anything. But to suddenly discover Yisrael, especially after Alexander's vision and what the meaning was of the Beis HaMikdash, and then to see in them everything that was precisely the different than what it was that Yovan was, and particularly Brit Kodesh, that disturbed them very profoundly, because the nature of Brit was that the body itself was not considered to be perfect. It was not considered to be something that could be worshipped as an ideal, and that they would be able to measure themselves against that which was given by nature. But rather, it was the insight of humanity and the commitment to the future and the achievement, which might be achievement by nerds and not by beautiful-looking young men fighting in the Olympics. This was something that was extremely challenging to Yavan, and because of that, the idea was, again, in terms of Kabbalah, was literally against Brit Kodesh. And so this became a fundamental breakdown between Yisrael and Yavan that came specifically at this point when it was that they wanted to take over the Beit HaMikdash. And this was the entire period. I mean, okay, according to Rashi, this is referring to the Brit Kodesh of the Romans. In other words, that was after the 26 years, and they weren't going to keep that Brit Kodesh. But according to the other approaches that we've arrived at the moment of the Hanukkah ideas, so then there was the whole question of who was in charge of the Kuna Gedela, and this was the Maisa, that there was the Chonyo, and the Gemara talks about the Bayit that was built in Alexandria because of this whole Maisa. So what happened was is that there was one who was a Tzeduki, there was one Kohen Gadol, although the Greek name was Jason, that was only because of the Hellenization, of course. His real name was Yeshua, and he was the brother of Chonyo. So because, for some reason, there was a breakdown between Jason and Antiochus, so Chonyo became, and this was, again, he also was a Tzeduki, he changed his name to Menelaus, and all kinds of money was passing hands, and the question was whether they were kosher kahuna. There's arguments about whether they were even really got. And they were both committed to the idea of destroying the Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash and helping the Yevanim to take over culturally Eretz Yisrael. Then what happened was that Jason, who was in this this fight with Antiochus and was never backed him, there was this Shmua went out that Antiochus had died, so he brought an army and attacked Yerushalayim. And as soon as Antiochus, whose rumors of whose death were very exaggerated, as soon as he came back to Yerushalayim, this was a disaster, and he killed all of the people that were with Jason. There was a tremendous amount of horrors that were committed against Klal Yisrael at that point as well. And so there will be a time when the same Antiochus is going to come back and invade the south. However, it's not going to be the way it was the first time. Again, what the first time and what the last time is not clear. It depends. In other words, if the first time was when he came in while Cleopatra was around, and the last time, meaning the time that was at the beginning of the Malchus of Ptolemy's sixth, but if you learn the other way, that there never was two separate things, and it must mean with the Ma'at Goi, and that was the first time, and then with the gigantic army, that's the second time, meaning that he had used that time to build up. But in any event, something terrible, a disaster overtook him. What was that? Uvo, uvo, siyim kitim. What happened was that the navy of the Kitim actually came to the aid of Mitzrayim. At least that's the Zikr Mashmos. In the Gemara, Si Adir is a reference always to boats. Although Rashi says Siyim is Siot, Siot meaning just that there were groups, bands, like we would use of robbers. What's interesting is that the Kitim, or the Maisa, Targum Unklus has Kitim, meaning Romi. And the Targum Yonason gives over your Kitim as Constantina, which is Constantinople. That is also Roman. That was the place where the Romans ruled in Israel, which also Rashi had. And by the way, there is a mess up of Rashi, apparently by the censors, but Lomaisa Rashi follows Constantina or Romoi in the corrected Yersaot. The question is, who are the Kitim? Now, in Bereishis, in the whole story of the Bnei Noach, Kitim are from Yevonim.
specifically the Italians. So, again, the whole thing may come back to Rome in this fashion, but they went to face down the what they viewed at this point, the danger to Rome in Antiochus, and they actually faced him down. The Nicha, he was crushed, and he had to back out. And there's a famous story where Antiochus asked for time, and the Roman general, Papilius, met him and told him that he's gonna have to determine right now what he wants to do, because either he withdraws or the Romans are going to fight. So he said, okay, well, how much time, when do you want an answer? So in true Chodia Magal fashion, Papilius draws a circle around him, and he says to him, well, it's fine. Take as long as you want, as long as you don't leave the circle before you give me the answer, which was an unbelievable design. And at that point, he surrendered, but he was really, really needed to prove his manliness somewhere. And of course, when someone needs to prove their manliness, the place that they turn to is against Klal Yisrael. And therefore, Vishov Vizahama Brit Kodesh Vyasa. And so he went back to take out his anger at the Bris Kodesh, because he went from a triumph towards Israel. And indeed, he actually won, because what happened is that he got into Yerushalayim once again through Armumiyut. He didn't put it into a siege. And once he was inside of Yerushalayim, because he had supporters inside, the ones who were on the side of the Bris Kodesh and who were attempting to fight against the whole Hellenization and the Tzedukim, he killed many, many of those people, and he stole many things from Yerushalayim. And not only that, but because he had been in Yerushalayim and had gotten a gander at the Beit HaMikdash, he not only that, but came back again, and this was actually 2 years later, he returned, and he was Yavin. Now, Yavin means to two ways. Let's take it in a simple way. Yavin alozvei brit kodesh, he had an agreement, he had an understanding. Yavin in the sense of understanding on those who were the tzedukim, and they had left the brit kodesh, and because of that, they supported him. And at that time, Josephus has the story that at that time, he went into Beis HaMikdash and took away tremendous, tremendous amount of, he took away the menorah, according to Josephus, he took away the Mizbeach HaTzov, he took away the Shulchan, and a lot of the Kalim. This is when he asked for bringing the Korban Tamid, and he killed tens of thousands of people, brought many captives with him. So this was an absolute disaster. The other approach of Vayoven was Vebri Kodesh, was that he had part of his plan, Vayoven in the sense of his ultimate plan. So Vayoven was Vebri Kodesh, his plan was to see to it that there would be no one left that would be part of Brit Kodesh. So he wanted to see to it that everybody would leave the Brit Kodesh. And another explanation that some learn is, but he had his plans even against his supposed allies, the Ozvei Brit Kodesh. Now remember that Rashi is consistent in his approach that at this point we're not even talking about, we're past the time of the Maccabim. According to Rashi, that period we talked about earlier in the parak. Now we're already at the point where Aristobulus is brought in now, the Romans are not keeping their Brit that they had made with Yisrael, and they are now attacking the Beis HaMikdash, and they're attacking Eretz Yisrael, and so that's what I'm saying, Vizom HaBrit Kodesh, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be the one who was angry because of Sinas Chinam, and that they were themselves had destroyed the nature of Brit Kodesh, which is Mechayev, a connection between Yisrael. So because of that, the Romans were able to be successful and to destroy the Beit HaMikdash itself. So according to Rashi's approach, the next pasuk is, we reference the Churban, so Uzroim Mimenu Yamoda, there will be many arms that came from him. And then we find the lashon of the armed forces, the zeroim. The chilulu hamikdash, they will be mechal the Beis HaMikdash. Hamaoz and they siru hatamid. The Beis HaMikdash was the maoz, was the rock strength of Klal Yisrael. They will stop the tamid from being brought. V'natnu hashikutz mishomim. Instead, they will put up this nauseating abomination. And that was the story of. This is already going ahead another 52 years. This is after Bar Kokhba was destroyed by Hadrian. He built, now as we saw before, he built a mikdash for Avodah Zarah on the place of the Beit HaMikdash. So that was different between the Sheket and the Shikutz Bishomim that we see here, and the Pesha, which is a reference to the Mosque of Omar, and the non-open Avodah Zarah, which is nonetheless a horrible thing to have in a Makom Kodesh. And here it's referring to the actual Mikdash of the Avodah Zarah itself that's on the, on the Mokom HaMikdash. So this would be the way that Rashi would have been. If we're talking about now the way that we have, that we still have the period of Antiochus, so that it means that the Mikdash HaMa'oz, and this is now the Mikdash that was built in tremendous strength, that's referring to the Binyan of Hurdis. So it's now something that was so powerful because he not only did he rebuild the Beis HaMikdash and make it very strong, but he also built the entire area, which is called the Citadel. And that had been built earlier by the early Chashmonai, and this is the famous Antonia Fortress. And it was so powerful that when Titus came, he knew that unless he was going to be able to be Kovesh Antonia, he would never be able to conquer Yerushalayim as a whole. So it could be that that's what it's saying. Hamikdash HaMa'oz is the base of Mikdash that had been built by Gurdis, together with the Ma'oz Antonium, which had become tremendously fortified and strong at this point. And then it's going now, referring now to the period of Gurdis. And the Korban HaTamid, which was prevented from being brought before. Now, if we look back in the Perek Tet, in Pasuk Chaf Zayin, it seems pretty clear that the words are almost the same. Because it says over there exactly these words about the Malchus, the big Malchus, Malchus HaRevi'it. So there it says, V'chatziah Shavua Yashbit Zevach U'Mincha V'Aknaf Shikutim Shomeim V'yad Kalav V'Nechratza Titach HaShomeim. The implications is that we are really talking about over here, this last period. So we've sort of switched ahead. And the truth is that it's important, I think, for us to recognize that all of these different approaches, this back and forth, is referring to this Antiochus, that Antiochus, the period of Hashmonaim, is referring to the Romans in some places, which clearly everybody has to admit it's referring to the Romans. Maybe it's even referring to the Bar Kokhba, which is another half a century in the future, and so on and so forth, is not really an issue. Because again, if we're talking about patterns, and all that we're meant to understand is the way that Yisrael is impacted by certain patterns. And these patterns are so important that, as the Rambam says, the nature of the Tanyas are there in order to get us to understand patterns. Once we recognize patterns, then it is possible for us to deal with it. Whereas if we get into details about one particular thing, another particular thing, it's exactly the same as, I'm sure you've had the experience of arguing with your children. You take something, and obviously it can be interpreted this way, it can be interpreted that way, and there's any number of interpretations. The only thing that allows you to be able to look at something from with some level of objectivity is when you get sufficient data to be able to see the overall pattern and recognize Mahat Sada Shaveh Shabem. And generally, the Tzadah Shaveh Shabem is exactly what is wrong. And then you can face up to what is wrong. But as long as we deal with the particulars, there's nothing that we can do. So year two, it really doesn't matter very much whether we're talking about the pattern at the time of the Romans and the Sidas Chinam then, or we're talking about the breakdown between the Tzedukim and the Prushim and the issues at the time of Yovan, or we're talking about Yosef the Echav, or we're talking about the Esar Rugim Malchus. The point is that we need to understand the patterns. And therefore, the question of the confusion, it may not be confusion. It's very possible that the Malach himself, being outside of this entire framing of time that we insist so powerfully on having an exactly linear way of looking at this thing, as I mentioned earlier in one of the shiurim, it's not any different than Shirat HaZino itself. That over there, as Rashi says, who cares whether it's before or after? It doesn't have to have a particular structure that is limited to a particular time. What Moshe Rabbeinu and HaZino is trying to show us is the nature of pattern. And here too, if that's the case, then the real meaning of these issues of the Neil is not to see it as particularly one period or another, but to recognize that things work out this way. And it's almost a truism now at the Kalal Yisrael, the way it is that they're going to get blamed for something, or the way it is that in attempting to bring in other powers, they're going to end up being the ones that are destroyed, or the fact that anything that you try to do for your enemies is going to never be forgiven, and all of the snide comments that we've already developed that have become almost truisms. And this is all part of the learning from the bitter experience of the history that Daniel is being shown in advance, to perhaps be able to give over the understanding of what to look for before we have to learn in this very painful evolutionary way over a period of thousands of years. As we saw, this was the whole point of it. As he was told by Gavriel, you know, if you can get people to understand, then this period of the Beit HaMikdash, instead of culminating in the ultimate destruction and the Sivas Chinam, will be the beginning of a final Geula. We know that the results of that are in, but unfortunately, the inability to learn from patterns seems to be precisely, if not worse than it ever was, at least precisely, as the Rambam says, the same Maasim and the same issues that affect us today. Now, throughout the ages, these patterns have indeed been used by people during their period to locate themselves along the line
lines of Daniil. Now, I must admit that often it appears that they're really taking it seriously, that this was the full extent of Daniil's intent. But the truth is, it's not so bad, because in reality, the patterns themselves may be applicable again and again and again. It's not surprising that people find themselves throughout history with sense of recognition of having been in this place. Which brings us here to a completely different approach from this pasuk on, and that is that according to Rabbi Arbanel, suggests that maybe here in Lamed Aleph, as opposed to almost everyone else who learns that we've arrived now at the period of the Romans, Rabbi Arbanel sees this as a continuation of the approaches before that was referring to Antiochus' arrival. And so according to this, he learns that this period is the period of Hanukkah. So for Zor'im imenu yamodu, what that means is that Antiochus will leave now his people in Eretz Yisrael, even though he left. And this, of course, was Lysias. And at this point, it was already after the Hashmonaim had made trouble, and he was ready to attack the entire Yehuda, but decided to first go to Paras in order to raise all of what he needed to create an army big enough to take care of Yehuda, which is interesting. Lamaisa, historically, there were a lot of rebellions all across Antiochus's areas, and it wasn't only that he needed to concentrate entirely on the Jews, which is, of course, much more likely. And so when it goes on to say, V'chilala Mikdash Hama'oz, that means that he, at that time when he came back, it doesn't say there, and I was referring back to the previous pasuk, it doesn't say what he did against the Beis HaMikdash, against the Bris Kodesh, and now it's saying this is what he did. He went ahead and he was Mechal the Beit HaMikdash, and that was the Yesiru HaTamid, which was the three-year Hafsaka in the Korban Tamid, V'natnu HaShikot Mishomeim, that he set up over Mizbeach to Avodah Zarah, U'mashi Brit Yachaniv, and it was Makariv, all of the people that were against the Prushim. This was the famous story where the Tzedukim wanted to take over the Kahuna Gedolah. They said that they were ready entirely to become like the Yevonim and to forget all about Terah. And this is when they asked to build the famous gymnasium in Yerushalayim. And so it was Machanif them. So he, again, in English, difficult to find the word for Machanif. I mean, the simple word is to flatter. And then the Am, Yodei Elohav, would be a reference over here to the Hashmonaim. This would be those who were committed. And this is the Mashiach Brit Yachanif B'chalakotzi. He'll go together with those who wanted to become like the Yevanim. And the Am that was left, knowing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, those people, refers to Matzio and his group, they, in the end, will be Achaziku V'yasuf. They are going to rebel, they will be strong, and they will accomplish, and they will end up destroying the things that he had done, the Beis HaMikdash, and they'll get rid of the Avodah Zarah, and they'll once again rebuild the mitzvahs that that had been all of the gezeiros that had been against Rosh Chodesh and against Mila and so on. And even though it's true that Matyo Kohen Gadol died not long after the beginning of the rebellion, it was Yehuda HaMakabi and he made this Yehuda HaMakabi. We know that he destroyed the Shomronim, and then he destroyed the army of the Avantiochus and the Beit Horon, and then they sent an even bigger army. This was the army of Nicanor, and this was the famous defeat of Yehuda at Emmaus, which we now have a parquet. And then he got together a tremendous army. This is in those days. I mean, we're talking about 50,000 people and more. And this was once again, this was so great that it was maybe even 10 to 1, some say 6 to 1, the size of the army of the Jews. And this near Yerushalayim and Beit Zur, and again, Yehuda HaMakabi won, and they had to run away. The entire group ran away to Syria, and then this was the year in which they ended up making the Neiros Hanukkah, and they, in fact, will be Achaziku, and this could be Achaziku could be that they made themselves fortified, and they prepared themselves to be able to fight and to withstand the Greeks, Viasu, and they ended up accomplishing what it was that they set out to do, and all of the victories that followed, and the Chanukah HaMizbeach, and the Chanukah HaMikdash, and this was the tremendous Nes of Hanukkah, and this was Yavinu Rabbi. Because of that, the Chachmei Hador, they went out, and they were
were Mechazik, the people at the time, and they showed them the Nes Hanukkah, and they made a new Gezerah that everybody should light the Nes Hanukkah. Miniach Shalul Vechera Vilehava Mishvi Vizai Yamim, and they will indeed be Nirshal, they will fall, they will stumble by the Chera, by the sword, and by the fire, and through captivity, and through being the victims of all of the plunder of war for Yamim, for years. And nonetheless, Ubi Kashlam Yazu Ezer Ma'at, and when they fall, and they stumble, they will be helped a little bit. So this again, according to Barbanel, this is referring to those who were Meisr Nefesh, Al-Kiddush Hashem, whether it was Becherev, or whether they were burned alive, and during the period where the Yavanim made them such tzar, even though they had very, very little, HaKadosh Baruch Hu helped them, enabled them to be Mekaber, and they would be helped. Many people will join them, but will only join them in trickery and with slipperiness. According to the Abarbanel, again, we'll go back and review this according to the other approaches, but according to the Abarbanel, this continues on with the Chashmonai, which many of those who had actually been mityavnim, when they saw the Nisei Hanukkah and they saw that the Chashmonai were victorious, so they claimed that they were really, you know, forced by the Greeks, and that they always wanted to become able to be Shemra Mitzvahs, and that this was wonderful, and at the moment they were able to turn against them, they indeed turned against them, and caused even the death of the members of the Chashmonaim themselves, including even the one who was going to be the real successor of Matityahu, which was his son Shimon. He was murdered. He was murdered even by his own son-in-law, who meanwhile managed to kill his wife and two of his sons. It was absolutely a disaster. And almost Yochanan Hyrcanus, which was in the end really the Yorish, was almost killed and managed to get away. And then continues the Pasuk of Inamaskilim, Yikashlu, and some of those who are really the Chachomim and understanding, they will themselves stumble in order litzrof behem levarer lulabein adeket ki od lamoed. They are for the purpose, obviously not conscious purpose, but because they fell themselves, even among those who had wrought all of these nisim. This is an unbelievable, horrifying thing, of which Matisyo had five sons. Four of them were killed during the fighting against the Yevanim, or really against the Malchus of the Tzafon, against Syria. And this was Litzrof then. This was an order to be Mitzarif Yisro. And unfortunately, as the Rambam told us, that the one who attempts to be Mashiach, if he doesn't succeed, so then he's considered like the Malchus based of it, a tzaddikim, but clearly it wasn't meant to be the real Mashiach. And indeed, over here as well, that there's going to be, as we're going to see in the end, that the tzaras of the period and the constant new challenges that will come up until Mashiach are going to affect, as we know, even we know that even Yochanan Kohen Gadol in the end became a tzaddiki. Oh, horrible, horrible thing. And as the Rambam writes in the Geres Teiman, that even some of the greatest maskilim, that there's a limit to how much a person can take. And there are those of them who will be nichshal. And therefore, he told the Jews in Teiman that this is something that has to be understood. And it doesn't mean that chas v'shalom, that people are rishayim because of the fact that they end up being, or that they were wrong all along. And that there's always kishlonot in the end because of the tremendous, tremendous tzar of this period. And as the Gemara says, even Hanani Mishra v'Azari, it's all very nice that they were willing to give up their lives in a moment of being thrown in by others to death. But if they had been tortured, then they would have given in. It isn't a proof of anything that a person cannot withstand torture itself. So some learned this is, if they're learning that this is referring all the way, not like the Abarbanel, but that this is referring Bechlal throughout the entire period up until the coming of Mashiach itself. So then, as it says over here, Adet Ketz, the Pashtut is until the very, very end. Then it's referring to the fact that we have the Asara Rugi Malchut, and we have all of the people who have been killed, and the Crusades, and the Holocaust, and all of this is for the purpose of Levar, to see who can get through this and to be malabim, that is to get rid of the avinas of Yisrael, and that this will happen until actually it's time to etkate. The way my father Zatzal put it is that basically Mashiach has been paid for in advance, and that it's not necessary
necessary from this point on where we're at to think that there needs to be even greater tzaras than what Klal Yisrael has already gone through. Ki od lamoed, it is not the time yet. There is a time, and this is not yet the time. And then, v'yasach yiritzano hamelach, v'yitromein v'yitkadel al kol el. V'al elevim yidaber niflo, v'yitzliach ad kalazan, kinech ratza ne'esat. Now here, clearly, we are moving away from the period, even according to the Amar Benel, as the Pasuk has indicated, that there's going to be now a change until the 8th case. Now, if that's the case, let us go back now and see the pirush of this period according to the other Mefarshim.
Starting from Pasuk Lamed Aleph, which is where there's a strong divergence between those who learn that we're talking about the Romans and those like the Abar Benel, who learn it as a continuation of the story of Malchut Yavan. So that in Lamed Aleph, it seems pretty clear that what we're talking about now is where before in Lamed it was Uvo Vitzim Kitim, and that seems to be clear that the Romans headed off the Antiochus, at the very least, it was referring to that. And then as a result of what came about through the arguments of the Beit Hashmonai, so that the remez, according to the other approaches, the Ot Ket Salamo Eid, back in Pasukov Zayin, is already talking about the time that was left for the Korban, and this was remembered that we'd had earlier in the ninth Perek. We had the 62 weeks of years, and that came out in the time of the second Agrippas, and that was the Agrippas, who was yet from the family of Hordas, who was apparently a rather nasty fellow, as opposed to Agrippas that the Gemara talks about, his father, who was a very wonderful fellow of yours. So in any event, in Lamed Aleph, there's a convergence that we're talking over here about Rome, almost according to everyone. So Uzeroim Mimenu Ya'amodus, and this means once the Romans are there are going to be armed forces. Remember that word Uzeroim, that has such a modern ring to it, the arms. And the armed forces will come from him, which means that the Romans ultimately will invade. V'chilalu ha-migdash ha-ma'oz, and this now would refer to the Migdash ha-ma'oz as Bedafka, the Bayit that Hordas built, because the original Bayit, up until the time of Hordas, was not exactly a Ma'oz. It was very katana Bayit and run down, and was always a source of pain. It was Hordas that had turned it into a Ma'oz. Not only that, this is where the famous Antonia fortress that had been there for quite a while, but now at the time of Hordas, he turned it into a really first-class international Ma'oz. And so even Titus understood that if he doesn't destroy Antonia, that there's no way that he's going to be able to take over the city, because it was able to maintain a vast amount of, for a long time, of soldiers that would be a constant threat to any army that was invading. So this Roman now would have to come in to be Michal the Mikadash the Ma'oz, the Yisiro HaTamid, Minatuma Shikutz Mishomein. This then would be referring to, according to some, it's all the way, it's referring already to the time of Hadrianus, as we mentioned, where it was the Shikutz Mishomein, that was a reference to the statue of Zeus that was put there, and that was on the Mokam HaMikdash. This was a result, or this is a flip forward to the time of the merit of Bar Kokhba, and that caused so much of the response of the Romans to go out of their way to make things worse. Umayshi'e brit yachanif befalakot. And those now, they were machnifim, these were the Britzei Yisrael, that joined up with these Romans, and they actually pretended, not that it was all political, in other words, there was no real meaning to anything that was done, but they were happy to turn against Israel. But the Am Yodei Elohav, those who knew HaKadosh Baruch Hu, those who were the ones that were Sholem, B'yiras Hashem, they nonetheless, Yachaziku, they held on to the Torah, and not only that, V'yasu. They not only were Va'asu in terms of Asu, the Torah, in terms of the mitzvahs, but they were also Maskileyam Yavinu Rabim. It was at this point that we had the greatest flowering. There was the time of the Mishnah. This was Rebbe and the Chachomim. This was the Asur Arugi Malchus of the Gedali Yisrael, that they couldn't stand the fact that there were those who were Yodei Lehov, that were Magzik in Torah, and were Asu as Torah, and they were Mevinei Torah to people, and they spread the Mishnah and created greater and greater learning, as opposed to what they had been hoping between them. The Gezeris of the Yevanim, and following the Gezeris afterwards of Shmad, that they were hoping to be able to destroy Yisrael. Nonetheless, they were Matzliach, the Asu. So these were the ones that would be Derish, L'Ami Aretz, as Rashi puts it. And then, unfortunately, the Nichshalu, Becheref, Ubalava, Bishvi, Waviza, Yamim. And then for many years, and this will be at the worst possible times, they will fall to the sword. They will fall to the flames, and they will be nichshal. Some learn Nikshal means Manish. As we'll see later on in Lamedhe. So the Pash says there will be Nikshal, meaning that no one will help them to save them, and the greatest of the Gedolim and the Talmidei Chachamim and the most wonderful Kehilot throughout history will be consigned to the flames and to destruction. Ubi Kashlam. And when things get terribly bad and it looks like all is over for Yisrael, Yeyazru Ezer Me'at, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help them at least a little bit to be able to at least to make it through. Rashi learns that this is making through bribery. And this is really based on the Gemara. Gemara views the entire Malchus Edom as being fundamentally motivated by economics. And obviously, if we take a look in the actual Parsha, which Yaakov Avinu meets Esav and defines this period of the Malchus Arvias, his entire focus is on economics. And to teach Esav that it's worthwhile accepting bribes. You know, nothing's worthwhile fighting for. It could I tell... and of course, this was the gifts that Yaakov sent, and that's why the Gemara always makes fun of it. This is the Malchus that's always saying, have, keep paying, as Mitrape is always sticking out their hands. So it's all, if you give enough money to the party of your choice, they'll back Israel, you know. And this goes on, of course, how do you miss it? So that at the worst periods, it's always money. In a very deep way, of course, the position of Yisrael during the darkest times was always saved because of the need for Jewish money. Jewish money meaning not simply capital that only Jews had access to because of they were the only nation with international standing. It was a remarkable thing. All of the other Umayyads were at each other's throats, always. The only one who was able to go anywhere on earth and be able to find an entire fifth column like itself that speaks his language and that will accept him and share in what he wants were the Jews. So they were the only international presence for centuries and centuries. And of course, it was Jews that created the entire economic system that became the very thing that fed the wars of Esav, the victories of Esav, and the economic development of Esav. So that ironically, even the great banking family Rothschild actually means Reuter Shield, which is the shield of the Edom. So that it's the one that is Matzil Edom and provides for them. So this is always what it was that was, according to Rashi, is the meaning over here. The Ezer Ma'at, there was always a little bit of hope. A little bit of hope was always Jewish money.
It's always seen as a negative thing, the wandering Jew thing, where there was only...
Yeah, but Chazal say on the contrary. Yeah. You know, wandering Jew is Be'etzem. As the Rambam points out, even the Gabi Christianity, but Be'etzem, the idea of a Golus, Lo Niglu Yisrael, Lo Kedei, Lo Shiutos, Ve'em, Gerim. The idea of meeting Yisrael all around the earth has been a tremendous drive towards civilization and towards the spread of knowledge and science and so on. And this is part of course, the interaction of Yisrael V'Yavon. Remember that everybody recognizes that. The way they put it, Athens and Jerusalem as the two central amudim of how it is that humanity develops. But we understand that in the end, it's only Avram Avinu, who is going to be Marumas here later on by Daniel, and it's only Avram Avinu and his drive towards ultimate science and the Yediyah of Hashem Echad and everything that derives from that, and that drove even in the end Yavon into league with a nation of Edom that would provide the means to actually touch Bria with your dirty hands and not just by thinking about what you'd like. And that's very, very related. The combination is very related to what it is that Yaakov Avinu and Yisrael have to do. So that this is a vision of, as we saw earlier, when the Malach, he overhears the Malach asking about the human condition, and he's spoken to as if he's the representative of the human condition. It's important to note Daniel. It's important to note here that a lot of things that are very important to us don't really have much mention here. There were great things that happened. The Nes of Purim, there's no remez. The Nes of Hanukkah, maybe a little bit of remez. As a matter of fact, somewhere, and this is the Ubi Kashlam, and all was lost. Yehazru Ezer Ma'at. Ezer Ma'at referred to the Chashmonoim. Now, to say Ezer Ma'at, so okay, the Bar Menachos, Ezer Ma'at means, well, they were Ma'atim, maybe Rabim. But that's not the simple meaning. Ezer Ma'at is that, in a sense, it's a distraction from the real action. And that's one of the most astonishing things about the visions of Daniel, is that they're universal. They are not about Yisrael. Yes, they're about the impact of the universe on Yisrael, but the vision that you get is not a limited parochial sense of, yes, and it came time for this Godol and this generation. But nothing like that. I mean, the Jewish observer must go crazy with this. You know, like, what is Hamudiah going to do with Daniel? What are we listening to the news? You're turning on the TV. There's the internet. I mean, these are things that, well, how come you're not talking about what so-and-so did in Bnei Brak? I mean, it's not even we don't even give a whole pasuk to 170 years of Malchus Yisrael. That's amazing. So in other words, we needed to come, just as we saw in the previous parable, we need to come to a recognition of the breadth of the process of Geula and what it takes into consideration. The milieu within which Yisrael develops, and within which that Geula develops, which is the story of this parable, is a milieu that has very, very complex patterns. Within those patterns, things are happening for Yisrael, but it's not Daniel's interest in the book. And it's not HaKadosh Baruch Hu's desire to give to Daniel that he should be the one, even though he was involved in these things. He was there. There for the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. There for the story of Mordechai and Esther. There for all of the things that were happening in Poras. I mean, the man was actually present. And nonetheless, he, Bedavka, needed to be uplifted out of that and to get a sense of profound currents in humanity that have so many different types of implications, so that the local history that everybody attempted to read into from these things, they may all be true, but in a sense, it doesn't even matter. That's what's most important. It's this vast currents of history. And here, I mean, that comes out very, very strongly in the book. East versus West, North versus South, issues that come up again and again, which we look at as local. But the truth is, if you look over the course of history, these are unbelievably important currents. You talk about East versus West in the broadest sense, it's almost a different planet. You talk about the nature of North, really North versus South. Oh, it's a different culture, totally different culture. All types of different things evolve in the North that don't evolve in the South, and vice versa. It's remarkable stories, which in the end, East versus West, even in terms of a new world versus the old world, the differences between them, these kind of issues that people really don't think about very much. They think, you know, you look at history and say, isolated events, is this country, is that country. But there's much deeper, much more profound undercurrents that are here all along. And that's amazing, because the Gemara in Yuma goes directly from an analysis of Noach and his children, and Bnei Yefet, Gomer Magog, and learning about the dinim of Yaftalot Yimnei Yefet, V'yishkab all the shame, and the difference between Ashras Ashkina in shame, and that you can't have Ashras Ashkina, and those things that came from the Bnei Yefet, and it goes directly from there into the most incredible things about what's going to be ultimately of Atidim. Is Rome going to fall to Iran? Is Iran going to fall to Rome? This is the Machlokas and the Gemara. You know, questions that this is a gzeira min hashamayim, that nonetheless, despite the fact that Persia built the Beis HaMikdash and that Rome destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, that in the end Persia falls to the West, it's just a gzeira, even though you think it's a kal v'chomer home. That has to do with Bnei Yefet and Yaftar. Absolutely. The Gemara sees this as one vast flow. Of course, it has local implications. But if you analyze the very way in which the book is set up and the visions are set up, those patterns and sub-patterns happen within the vision. So if you start off with the major Arba Malchios, then those become the Arba breakup of the small Malchios, of Yavam, so to speak. And then within that, you have, once again, the little horde becomes the big. It's like nested. It even describes itself as being nested. So get that, the smaller and smaller levels. This is a fractal description of the same things that keep coming up again and again and again, these same patterns. And we're going to get to it at the end of time, where you think, wait a minute, we're way past the Melech HaTzafon and the Melech HaNegev. We're going to come to the end of times that is still ahead of us. We're going to talk about the silly Melech HaNegev and Melech HaTzafon, because there is no particular silly Melech HaNegev and Melech HaTzafon. I mean, there's been dozens and dozens and dozens of examples of what goes for the Melech HaTzafon. You know, the Melech HaNegev. Wait a minute, but you want to talk about Putin and some Meshuggah in Iran. Whatever it is, it's all representative of completely different takes on life. One of the most striking things about life on this planet is the amazing way in which history began again. I mean, this was like a story. An entire planet develops, and they're not even aware of the fact that half of the planet is somewhere else. It's an amazing...
You know, we don't even think about it. I mean, if you take away, if you'd be an anthropologist, you know, a galactic anthropologist, you know, you would think this is an astonishing story. That here you've got thousands of years of civilization and shipping and big Malchus, the Greeks and the Romans. They don't even know the planet on which they live. There's an entire new world to be discovered. And then these things have to, now, these patterns have to recreate themselves in completely new contexts. And it's truly new. I mean, it's so different, the new world and the old world. And yet you can see how profoundly these patterns once again becomes east and west and north and south, just like it always was. It's astonishing. And when you look at it from that point of view, you understand that the placement of Yisrael within all of these ebbs and flows is so complicated. I mean, you read the newspaper just over the course of 1 year, and you see how both. It's both. And I mean, you read the newspapers, and like one day to the next, you know, the Melech HaTzofen is, I mean, tonight, you know, Turkey says, don't worry, we'll help Lebanon. I was like, well, how did that happen? You know, it's like 3 years ago, you know, it's amazing. And Klai Yisrael has to find its place within all of this and learn to understand that in the end, it's an Am Levadad Yishkon, and that it has a completely different modality of existence and holding on in the midst of all of these wild currents that are pushing in so many different directions. And as our own experience of these different directions are brought together in Eretz Yisrael, that complexity itself is an amazing story within a story. This is an astonishing parak on that level. And it really is so much not what you would have expected, that a book that was coming to describe Yisrael and giving you hope for the future and giving you a sense of what's in store for thousands of years, what it would be about. You can barely find yourself in it. And that's a clue to the international, interplanetary, intergalactic stature of the nature of Yisrael. So that these ebbs and flows are, they're the local issues. And these are the things you're going to have to find yourself within. And so, yes, of course, they could be applied again and again to different circumstances. That's precisely what it would be that you would think. And those who can't learn from those ebbs and flows are doomed to repeat it. It's as simple as that. Because that's really what it's setting forth. That we've watched, even in recent times, again and again. And so, bikashlam yazu ezerman. Yeah, they'll be helped a little bit by bribing their way through, as is one approach. Or there's another approach, the other approaches as well, but let's wait a minute. The nevuah lehem rabim b'chalak lakot, and we will cause others, the rabim, to follow them by making life easy. And of course, that's the way that Rome does, the way that the West does. Everybody wants that easy life, slippery slide, the b'chalak lakot. It sounds so good. It's all about, you know, all about the magic kingdom. And the magic kingdom is the ultimate malchus revius. Umin hamaskilim yikashru. And those who are the maskilim that was said before, they will be nichshal. Rashi learns they will be nichshal in this parak. Because they will come to meet all kinds of cheshbonos, and everybody's going to come. Which, of course, we know that I mean, we look at it, you know, with perspective, and it's like, unfortunately, it was very tragic. But I mean, the number of false messiahs, and the number of mechashvei kitzim, and the different emdot of maskilim. You know, whose side are we on? Do we pray for Napoleon? It's the strangest things. We don't even think in this way anymore. But these maskilim would be choshvei kitzim, and expect that these things were going to teach them how it was they were supposed to act out on the local level. And all of that was absurd. Or the other meaning is, Bina Maskilim, the greatest Yidalim, and the greatest that we mentioned before of the Machzike Tera, they will be broken. Somewhere in the Rambam, where it's actually the Geres Teman, they will be Nifsha. So that given Yochanan Kohen Gadol, it comes to Tzeduki, Al-Titach Vasmachad Yomutcha, person never knows what could break him. And as the Gemara says, you know, if they had taken Hanani, Mishael, Azari and tortured them, they would have broken them too. It's easy to be thrown to your death, but there's limits that people have. And he's mechazik, the Teimanim. You know, even the maskilim be kashru, but that doesn't mean that you have to give up and that somebody who does that is a Russia, which of course people were telling them. But others learning kashru means to be destroyed. And this was in order litzrof behem lavarer velalabein ad ekit yodlamoed. This was in order to be mitzarech while Yisrael through these yisurim to be mevarer in the end that which needed to develop and to evolve out of Yisrael to be malabin their avenes, so that sometimes the tzaddikei ador are nitfosim because of the avenes ador. This is malabin the door, and this is going to go on for a very long time. Ad ekit yodlamoed. Don't think that just because it's horrible in your times that that means that Mashiach is right around the corner. Oh, yes, this melech. The Rashi learns this melech, not a melech. It is the, this is the description of the Chaya Harevi'it. So a melech means this malchus. Malchus Romi will end up, as the Gemara says, ruling over the entire world, doing whatever it wants. No one will be able to stand up against it. The Eben Ezra, and many who follow of various elements of the Eben Ezra, understand this to be a reference to Christianity. That this, now we're at the birth of Christianity, and V'yasakir Tzinoh HaMelech is a description of Constantine. So that what happens is that he actually, starting from a very lowly position, which is his life was actually in danger before he managed to run away in one drunken night, he gradually unified the empire again after everything that had taken place, and he founded Christianity as the religion of Rome. And it doesn't mean that he stopped all of Avodah Zarah, outright Avodah Zarah. If you take a look at the coins of Constantine, they still have the Avodah Hashemesh, for instance, on it. And sometimes the real reason it was Avodah Hashemesh was because at least that's, it's better than pure pantheism where every little thing is a god. You know? So the Shemesh, you know, okay, that's like a Shituf, which is maybe Mutter according to Rama. It's Mutter for going to have a Shituf. But he certainly, he was the one that brought together the Council of Nicaea, the ones who declared Yosh Kippipik, you know, to be divine. That was all Machlokas. You know, he was with the question of whether, I mean, if he wasn't there before, how could it be divine? That was the heresy. They had to explain how it was. You know, it's part of the mystery and so on. So this now, as we'll see, is also part of the Yasachir Tzono. I mean, you know, you can make up any nonsense theology that you want. V'yit Romei, V'yit Gadel. He'll be great and greater than any of the gods that they used to worship. And that was true. He actually, up until that time, they used to be as a matter of fact, right before Constantine, was the time of the greatest persecution of the Christians. They almost killed them, thrown to the lions. Free hunting when it comes to Christians. And he was the one that the Dafka went to the other extreme, first protecting after he became now Augustus. He started protecting the Christians. And then, as we'll see, he even starts building Christianity, building churches, and it became a very useful thing. Little did he realize that in the end, the church would become more powerful than the holy would be more powerful than the secular. But he thought that in getting a unified religion, that he would be actually able to unify the empire, and he was right, except it got out of control. But that's one of the beauties of Christianity, is that it can mean anything at all. And because of that, it's extremely attractive. It's, you know, you can have your God in Eden too, and it's like a really wonderful kind of thing. So it's, you have your little Avodah Zarah Getchka, but we don't believe in Avodah Zarah. You know, you can have your vision of monotheism, but you know, I mean, there's really, it's a transubstantiation, and it's really that, it's really a son, and there's always a mother you can hold on to, and a, you know, and bleeding pizza pies, and all, you know, it's got something for everybody. I mean, the variations of Christianity and the way that, like, the local populations all over the world, it's hilarious, the kinds of things that they come up with, you know, in the Congo. It's unbelievable things. If you look at it, it's hilarious, but it was an extremely brilliant move. As I mentioned before, that there's a strong tradition that the Chachamim were behind the whole thing. They try to get the, they actually sent Paul to try to bring this to other nations, so that they'll leave the Jews alone, so they can have what they want. It's a whole, there's a lot of Muslim to it. But then it's certainly gotten, there's gematrias in which Paul's name is, then they had to promise him. There's a lot of nice about it. But in any event, if this is a reference to Constantine, so then it's Vidgadel al Kol El. Vidgadel
means that he would make himself great, but that also means he'd got down, meaning he will find the Makar, the Shirish. So the Malbim understands that to mean he'll be Mavato Avodas Avilim. So everything that they used to worship until then will become bottled in this sort of monotheistic Christianity. But strangely, Val El Elin Yedaber Niflaot, he's going to make up these ridiculous mysteries of three is one, and one is three, and it's all, you know, but, and that will be now the El Elim. And nonetheless, Vitzliach, this guy is going to be so much like Ad Kol HaZaam, until the very end when HaKadosh Baruch Hu's anger against Klal Yisrael is finished, and then he's ready to bring Mashiach finally. But these horrible things that are all going to happen in this warm time, and this moed, adet ketz, ki nechratza nesata, this is a gezera in the Shamayim, and only when this gezera is over, then we can hope for an end to this mishigas. But the amount of absurdity that people will believe in and will go for is absolutely mind-boggling, only because min hashamayim there was a gezera that this should be the situation among humans. The alalohevotav lo yavin, he will not go back. I mean, after all, Jesus is a fine Jewish boy, you know. But these guys, they won't go back to try to understand it. And where does all of this come from? Avram Yitzchak Miyakov, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's talk about El Elim. What about the Father? All you're interested in is the Holy Ghost. I mean, you know, so fine. It sounds crazy. But believe it or not, he won't know anything about God and he won't know anything about sex. V'alchemdat nashim. Because these guys are so crazy, they're going to outlaw having wives for their komarim. That's how nutty they are. They'll call Allah lo yavin, and they won't really have any insight about these gods. But the Malbim is a Maila. They will worship only what they believe is monotheistic. The truth is, it's a machlokas rishenim and a machlokas apeskin whether these weird beliefs are indeed monotheistic for goyim, because they're really shutvis and shituf. Remember, we spoke earlier about HaKadosh Baruch Hu was chalak lehem lechol ha'amim, that they're tachat sarim. So because of that, there's even, as the Zohar says in the parsha of the Megadeth, so over there it says two separate things. One, an iser of ish asher yikalel et Elohav. The Zohar says that means a goy who curses his personal God. So somebody curses Jesus Christ. So then that's blasphemy. Unbelievable Zohar. Because since to the goyim, this is the most that they have of the closest of the concept to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As the Gemara Menachos talks about, that it asks how it's possible for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to say that Gadol Shmi Ba'Goyim, and Minchaz Torah Muktar, and the Shmi. The Gemara says, what do you mean? It's always Tavay Yisorah. So the Gemara, it doesn't matter, but they're all makir that Tavay Yisorah is only a manifestation of, they call HaKadosh Baruch Hu Elohei Elohim. They understand that there's some type of hierarchy. They don't have a connection directly to the Siva Rishayna. But the Malbim's lashon is the Kol Eloya means he will lo yavdu rak la Siva Rishayna. They won't really worship all of these gods. And then what will happen is ki al kol yidgadal, that now he will come along and say that he is really the one that they should worship, and it's referring to Yashka, referring to Muhammad. There's a whole pirush, by the way, that goes through all these sukkim as a description of what happens during the Arab expansion. And as I say, again, it's all true. It's all south versus north and east versus west. And those things manifest themselves in the strangest of ways. He will give some honor to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that was standing Aviv Shabbat Shamayim when the Migdash was Al Kano. He'll give covet. But nonetheless, make up these gods. That he'll be v'chabed v'zahav v'kesev v'even yikara v'chamudot. They will become fabulously wealthy, and they'll use this wealth to build churches. The Asalim Mivzerei Mozim, churches that look like fortresses all over the place, building these crazy buildings that will cost millions and millions and hundreds of years to build. Fill them up with these ridiculous icons and saints and statues and Imeloham Echar, Asher Yakir Yarbekavod, and whoever the church recognizes, that's the guys that they will take good care of.
That's all Khanifa, it's all hypocrisy, it's all political power. It's all about the ones that pay lip service to these gods. They're the ones that are going to get the money. Vim shilam barabim. And now he's going to see that the priests are going to be the one in charge. The adamai yechalek b'mechir, give them land at cost price. Cost price. The church will become the greatest feudal lord, taking over the entire Middle Ages. It's a horrific thing. All thinking that this was a nice way to unify the empire. Oh boy, will we learn. Ubeit kates yitnagach imo melech ha-negev. And this isn't the same silly melech ha-negev we're talking about before. We're already 2,000 years beyond that. So you see again how we're using these terms. There's no way to learn kimat, but this is all still the story of whatever, the breakup of the Yavanim. It's so clear we're ready to use the same terms for periods of history that are millennia apart, for all types of completely different issue, and it doesn't matter. So when the time comes, this is already a remnant of Mechamed Gog and Magog. So Gog of Magog is a melech from the Tzafon. He comes from the Tzafon. So this is an entirely northern vision. You know, what is that? Whatever. Again, it really doesn't matter because it's a northern vision. It doesn't matter how it manifests itself in practical terms. You know, I mean, so you have all these crazy things going on all the time. You know, only as the Rambam says, it's only la'achra ha'mais that you'll understand what element of the north or what that it's going to be referring to. Because it's not meant to be prophecy. It isn't prophecy. And therefore, sitting there and trying to analyze it when it isn't meant to be analyzed locally is a waste of time, as the Ibn Ezra says. I'm not going to waste my time and your time in going through all the little historical things which turned out, none of them turned out to be true anyway, and it really doesn't matter. And, you know, even if we read every history book under the sun, we wouldn't know what was going on. He says, no, I'm not going to do that. What's the point in doing that? If the Ibn Ezra can feel that way, I mean, I wasn't going to go through this without at least hearing, you know, some elements of a different proportion. But the truth is, it would be more important, especially Bizbanenu, to concentrate on the vast flow of these malchios, the nested levels of these four malchios, to get a better sense of what it is. But okay, we're to some extent limited by all the mafarshim that came before. And so he's going to build these churches. They're going to become now in charge of the land. The poor populace is going to be servants, basically, to these obscene creation. And then Beit Kates, the Melech HaNegev, is going to go once again. Yisrael will storm him. The Melech HaTzafon, the Rechev, the Farashim, the Voniot Rabot, massive armies, massive weaponry. Ubaba Aratzot, Vishatav Yavar, will come into all the lands. The Aratzot surrounding Eretz Yisrael, as we'll see. Ubaba Eretz HaTzvi. Oh, he will flood his way, coming into Eretz Yisrael. V'rabot Yikashelu. Many, many will fail at that point because of the horrific pressures of those times. And many of the lands surrounding Eretz Yisrael will be nichshal in, meaning yikashelu in a simple sense. Yechoshu, as the Malba learns, they won't be able to stand up against it. So that it becomes now a very, very strongly run from afar type of situation throughout the Middle East, which is exactly what we see happening. So the areas around the Eretz Tzvi will be influenced by the Melech HaNegev and the Melech HaTzafon, which is, I mean, 5 years ago somebody would have told you the situation that you would have laughed at them. I mean, to think that poros should be the ones that are going to be running the countries of the Namanid, it's crazy. It's difficult to believe that such things could happen so quickly. And the Ela Yimotu Miyado, now there will be some countries that will be able to maintain their independence even through this, and that is Edom, Moab, and at least Reshit B'nei Amon. Not all of Jordan, but at least some of the people around Amman will still be able, in other words, it will not penetrate completely into Eretz Yisrael and into the direct area around Eretz Yisrael. Vayishlach yado baratzot. He will stretch forth his hand against various countries. And don't think Eretz Mitzrayim is going to be the one that's going to save anybody. Eretz Mitzrayim lo tiyala fleita. Yeah, sure, they're going to protect your boundaries. They're going to make sure the weapons don't come in, the tunnels aren't built right. Forget about Eretz Mitzrayim. Umashal b'michmenei hazav. And you think all of these mines of gold down in South Africa, those things are not going to fall under the shlita of these malchias, v'akesev, v'chol chamudot b'tzrayim, v'lubim, v'kushim b'mitzadav. You're talking about Gaddafi, you're talking about all of the Arzot HaKushim, the Sudan, going all the way down through into the depths of Africa. All of this will march through Shmuel Kivalon, he means Rav, he means Safon. And then he will be worried. Things that he's hearing, developments of new weapons from the east, from the north. And he'll decide, that does it. There's only one thing to do. Festival. And then he will spread out his massive armies, his palatial tents, is a palace, between the seas, all the way up to the mountain of Eretz Yisrael, to Yerushalayim, Tarzion, and will come to his end, and there will be no one that can save him from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's din.